Podcast 104, Rocket Mass Heaters with Ernie and Erica. Sponsored by my buddies at PantryParadis.com. They sell food preservation tools. Produce, prepare, preserve your own harvest.
All right, so I turn it on. See the blinking?
Reach it from here.
It's blinking, so it's recording. That's how you know.
Cool.
All right, so I'm here with Ernie and Erica. We're going to talk about setting things on fire, I suppose. Well, rocket mass heaters, rocket stoves. We have a list of stuff that people asked. And we're having breakfast. In fact, here, Erica, hold this thing, if you don't mind.
Uh-huh.
So the little recorderoo is there. See it?
Okay.
And this is the way I normally hold it, but you hold it whatever way you want. But and I'm going to get some food. We got fish.
Mine.
Mine.
Some eggs. This is off of chickens that are here on this piece of land.
Mm-hmm.
And now you guys are living in new digs.
Yes, we are.
Up
in the Okanagan Valley.
No, it's not the valley. It's the.
No, we're living in the Okanagan Highlands.
That's what it is, the Okanagan Highlands. Because it's like the valley, they don't have any snow down there.
They don't. I haven't been down there.
They do. They got some, but we got more.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It just seems like there wasn't very much, and then we came up here, and there's like gobs of snow. Now, you guys have had snow on the ground since October.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we're the first mountain south of Canada here, so we do get a fair amount of weather that many people would consider Canadian. But we'd like to say that it was because people kept asking us about rocket stoves in sub-zero weather, so we were going to come out and test them. But really, honestly, we moved on top of this mountain because Ernie wants to build a big boat.
Well, now we're just stone's throw away from Canada, ain't we?
Yeah, I mean,
miles.
You could
15 miles.
You okay. Could, if you were good at it, you could probably hang glide from the hill up there into Canada.
Into Canada.
I was thinking about whether we wanted that for an escape.
Did they stop your hang glider midair and ask if you have anything to declare?
What's that line, you know?
I actually went as far as thinking maybe we need a translucent winged hang glider. Could be a little more stealthy.
Okay. All right. So here, let me hold that for a sec because I have to share it. Look, I'm eating breakfast. I'm going to make extra smacky sounds. All right.
Somebody told you that it was rude to make noises while podcasting, didn't they?
They did. How did you know?
Sometimes these things come on. You know?
Somebody told me, don't make smacky sounds while you're making a podcast. And this is for them. That's fish. I'm eating fish. What kind of fish is this?
That is swai.
Swai?
Swai.
I've never heard of swai.
Swai is one of the, I believe it's a South American fish that they're pond raising. Like tilapia?
Right.
That's a swai.
So tilapia's cousin or something.
Nah, I'm not sure what exactly the relationship is. I think it's actually a different, I don't think it's a cichlid like tilapia. I believe tilapia is a cichlid.
Okay. Well, so is this from somebody's pond around here?
No. No. That is the, they don't call it organic, but the ponds that one of the grocery stores buys from around here are natural spring fed. So instead of being nasty, been in the water too long, still water thing, these guys actually get oxygen minerals that they need, and they're not like isolated in a fish tank.
All right.
You're hoping to make us look like fancy organic everything people, but we're not. Like this is more like the commercial fisherman fourth generation response to salmon prices and the option of buying crappy cod for half of the salmon prices. And then there's swai at reasonable prices that's grown in a reasonable way. So
on this land there's at least two sea dogs that need to have daily fish. Three sea dogs.
Janine was a commercial fisherman as well for a while.
So on this land, there's three sea dogs that need to have regular fish.
And I think I'm a sea puppy at this point.
Oh, okay. All right. All right. And so then stuff like this happens. You get this. Okay. All right. So now, last night at dinner, we were serenaded by some voices from the past. It was the podcast we called Boom Squish. So it was me and Caleb and Krista talking about heat and water with Rocket Mass Heaters. And so the most important thing is that everything that I said was utterly and completely accurate. Is that right?
Yes.
Pretty darn close.
Okay, really, that's the most important part, summary of the whole thing, is that I'm awesome.
Go ball.
And I'm not out there making things worse.
Right.
We appreciate that about you.
So, what other comments do you have about, what else, anything else to add to the Boom Squish?
Well, some of you may notice that I am telling people basically how to heat water with the rocket stove.
I think there's an important distinction. You're mostly telling people how not to heat water with a rocket stove, and if they know enough about plumbing to figure out the ways to do it after having been told some of the ways not to do it, then it works out well.
Yeah.
If it's your first plumbing project, then you're probably not going to get enough information from Renew to try it, which is a good thing.
So I'm telling some people where to put the heating coil that's going to be safest on the rocket stove. Now, there's like five or six designs out there that people have floated around that, in my opinion, are A, dangerous, and B, ludicrous, because they don't understand how the rocket stove actually works. And I really don't like having dead clients. It hurts my business to have dead clients.
A dead client is not a repeat client.
Yeah, these are. So it seems to me, well, dead potential clients.
Dead potential clients, okay. Because, I consider everybody clients.
Because it seems like a lot of these people, they haven't even gotten to the point of talking to you yet.
No.
They went off and thought they had it figured out on their own.
Right.
And then they're dead. And then when they're dead, they just don't seem to give you money.
Well, they don't seem to give me money. They don't seem to send me email. You know, it's all that whole visitor thing. They didn't even write.
Just general love. Sending you love. They just don't do it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's worth knowing that Ernie has a passion for disaster relief. So if you go on the forums and you present a potential disaster, there's a really good chance that he's going to come and try to stop it or try to help you escape from it in some way, even though he finds it frustrating that people are out there creating potential disasters rather than reading the forums in the first place.
Well, I kind of think that one of the notes I have written down here is Ernie does not suffer fools gladly. And that's a quote from somebody that I read somewhere else. I think it might have been out on Reddit. And basically what they're saying is, whatever you do, if you're getting started in this, don't ask Ernie, ask Erica. Erica won't kill you. Ernie might. Ernie might have to kill you just to rescue your neighbors.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my hands are smaller and I type faster, so I can like type it out and then I can edit it so it actually kind of sounds like polite or compassionate or
And she's got a short memory.
And I haven't been in it as long as Ernie, so I'm not quite as burned out on some of the things that, for him, it's a repeat.
Right.
Repeat.
Ernie's heard it 800 times, and now...
And it starts to feel like he's already said that 100 times. Why aren't people listening?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, well, I've only said that 20 times. I wonder if I said it better with people listening.
Now, I have to admit that I don't have near the experience that either of you have. And I get pretty annoyed at a lot of the things that come up, and it's not like, and then people can even come up with a brand new question, and it's like look, I've made something that looks like it was invented by Dr. Seuss, and I've decided to call it a rocket mass heater.
Yeah.
And I haven't put any fire to it, but I think it's an improvement over Ernie's designs.
Right.
And then we never see a picture after that.
Well, or somebody sends me an email and tells me about how their rocket stove isn't working, and I wind up asking them questions and finally get it diagnosed down to they didn't actually build a rocket stove. They didn't build what's in the book. They didn't build what's on the forum. They built their own idea and put it in their house, and now it doesn't work. And I'm trying to diagnose it, and it's not exactly what it's supposed to be.
Well, like, for example, the heat riser or internal chimney is designed to be sort of tall and vertical-ish because heat rises. If your heat riser is neither tall nor vertical, like if you try to make it horizontal like the rest of the stove, then the heat doesn't rise in a non-vertical heat riser, and it's not going to draw. It's not going to work. And so if you make something that does not have a heat riser of a tallish and verticalish kind of shape, it's not a rocket mass heater. There are a number of other things you can also do that make it not a rocket mass heater, but I'm trying to say that one better so people get it. Stop trying that particular thing and calling it a rocket mass heater.
Stop calling your crazy rocket mass heater.
Stop
making stupid shit and calling it a rocket mass heater or a rocket stove, and then having the insulting question of why does my rocket mass heater not work? And it's like, I don't know what you've created there, but it is nothing even like a rocket mass heater.
Our crazy is called rocket mass heater. If you invent a new kind of crazy and somehow make it work, call it whatever you want. You invented it. You become famous on your turf. But bringing extra crazy to rocket mass heaters is not helping our cause.
Woody fire of death.
Yeah.
Boom squish.
Yeah, boom squish. What we're trying to do with the heaters, and this is kind of turning into a real problem, because everybody's experimenting around and calling everything a rocket mass heater, if somebody burns down their house, or it blows up, or... you know, the neighbor dies from smoke inhalation. What's going to happen is everybody's going to say, well, it was a rocket mass heater that did this.
That must be why it didn't
work. That must be why it didn't work.
And rocket mass heaters therefore suck.
Exactly. Rocket mass heaters therefore suck. So.
And anybody that tries to put one in and gets a code inspector called on them, you just screwed them as well as everybody else that's trying to get them to work.
Right, right. Impeding the whole thing. You're screwing everything up for everybody.
Right. And
and it's bizarre how people who come into this space, their first thought is to come up with something that's not in the recipes in front of them.
Right.
They have to come up. They feel above it all, and they don't know anything about fluid dynamics or any of that stuff, and yet they feel like they got it all figured out, and they're going to make something, and then of course what they make is a disaster, and then because they just don't know. They just don't know.
Well, and after 700 stoves and doing the hybrids and doing all the changes and trying external air inlets and putting air in the barrel late in the burn cycle and running the exhaust out halfway down the barrel and all of this other stuff, okay, I've done most of these things on a testbed where I had control over everything and could look at it.
And no neighbors for about a mile.
Yeah, no neighbors for about a mile. So it somewhat mystifies me why I can say, okay, this works, and somebody says, well, it's not burning hot enough, or it's not rockety enough. And I'm going, well, you're right. It's not as rockety as you think it's supposed to be. But it will work over a long period of time. It's called robustness. Okay? We basically settled on the most robust system that we know how to build now. But when you start making changes like pulling the exhaust halfway out of the barrel halfway down, it's no longer robust. It's a special thing. Because it's not going to burn in all situations. It's not going to put out the amount of heat that you need all the time. And I get a little frustrated about that. Quite frankly, when somebody calls something that's not a rocket mass heater, it's something that they've come up with. Because having the J-tube doesn't make it a rocket mass heater.
Having horizontal pipes in it doesn't make it a rocket mass heater. The rocket mass heater is a technical term. It has three parts. And it describes a particular set of inventions that have been worked out over, what, about 20 years?
Yeah.
Almost 30 now. And it is relatively new compared to masonry heaters, of which there are a lot of different designs that have been worked out over several hundred years. Rocket mass heaters are kind of in this vulnerable place right now that we'd like to see them move forward and become a more mainstream thing. I think, Paul, you were saying you'd love to see them in half the households in the northern U.S.
Right. And so
that's not going to happen if people keep building things that aren't a rocket mass heater, calling it a rocket mass heater, and then saying, why doesn't it work? Because what's going to come out is it doesn't work. And that's,
I want to say that 80% of the people that get started down the rocket mass heater path, 80% believe that what they want to do is some form of what they think is innovation. They're sure that they're smart and that they are so smart that they are innovators. And that rather than following a recipe, that what they're going to do, and this, and again, 80%. This is my impression at the moment. Please correct me if I'm wrong. I'm thinking 80% then go off and make something which they call a rocket mass heater, which is not. Now, I would think that the actually smart people, what they do is they follow a recipe for making an actual rocket mass heater or rocket stove, and then maybe follow another recipe, and after they've built two or three, then they start innovating and improving upon these designs.
Right.
As opposed to these other people who think that they're smart, but they're not, and then they start innovating before they've even made one, and they end up with something that's not that would not qualify by the experts as a rocket mass heater, and they're calling it a rocket mass heater, and they're just making things difficult, and frankly, and so then, and then I know Ernie gets livid pissed because they'll come out to Permies, they'll ask a question, and then Ernie gets so angry he won't answer any questions for several days. And it's because really what he needs to do is he needs to kill that person for the sake of Darwin's theory and all this other stuff, and to protect other people from the insanity of this person who thinks they're smart.
Well,
and so then
Ernie killing people isn't good for the reputation of rocket mass heaters either, so we kind of talk him down and we go do boats for a while.
There you go. Ernie just gets livid. And I think his getting angry is justified because, you know, and so I do think that that what we need to do collectively as a community, especially out on Permies, is that when we see somebody standing up and saying, look at my rocket mass heater, it is awesome, that we have a dozen people who come out and say, shut the fuck up! And say, that's not a rocket mass heater. Stop calling it a rocket mass heater. You're going to piss off Ernie, and then Ernie's not going to answer my questions.
Exactly.
That is one way to do it. Yeah.
Well, I think that's what needs to happen. So the pod people need to get out there and to help clean up the basic messes so that Ernie's focusing more on the more advanced questions that are done by people who've actually built these.
Just build one system the way it says and innovate from there.
And like, just dry stack it with your fire brick in your backyard. You don't have to buy extra fire brick. Just build the thing outdoors and make sure you know how it's supposed to work before you start adding features. Try those features outdoors where you're not poisoning your household before you put it in your house.
Right, because there's been some ridiculous. It's bizarre. I am shocked, and I see this stuff. And then I like a Reddit. I saw something, and I tried to help, and then I got downvoted. And it's like, you've got to be kidding me. You're about to do something stupid. I tried to help, and I got downvoted.
Well,
people sometimes want to see stupid on the internet, right? I mean, it's something you got to understand about the internet population. I think I would say the people who are quietly intelligent about this are going to tend to, even if they don't build a couple of rocket stoves themselves before they install it, they're going to go look at a couple. They're going to go look at somebody else's. They might come to a workshop. They might just go online and look at projects that you can actually see people sitting on it a year later and happy rather than just people starting it.
They might actually read the entire forum.
Or read the book, which is
or
available.
Read the book.
Right, that's another peeve. People, if you're going to ask a question, you might check the forum to see if it's already been asked.
Yeah,
Ernie's kind of getting a little burnt out on...
Yeah, I think actually the quietly intelligent people who do a little bit of homework first are the majority, but the people you're saying are the think you're smart people, the smart mouth people, tend to put all the pictures up and go for it, like, really loud, and so they tend to appear to be more prevalent than they are actually as a whole.
Maybe that's it. Maybe I'm measuring my anger levels or something as opposed to, like, actual numbers of people that I'm seeing.
And that's the thing is they do kind of suck it. Because it's a disaster waiting to happen, it's very exciting. It makes good television, so to speak. And it does tend to suck attention away from people who are sort of quietly trying to figure all the whole thing out and make something that's going to work for them without invoking doom.
Yeah, we don't have a problem with the innovation thing, right? In fact, we like the innovation thing, but you got to have a foundation to do the innovation from. And if you've not built one before, by the numbers, when you go out and innovate, you have no baseline. So you don't know how it's supposed to work in the first damn place.
And if you don't know Ernie or you don't know Yanto, you may not realize how much innovation and pushing those boundaries is already built in to the whole system. Like, they've done a lot of that work already. So if you want to innovate, you might take something that is, like, conventional and innovate off of that. And if you want to work with the Rocket Mass Heater, you might consider that some of that innovation is already built in.
So I think an important thing here is that, Erica, you have a degree in physics. And you are a teacher.
Yep.
And Ernie's a sea dog.
Who can make anything work because his life might depend on it someday.
But Ernie doesn't. It's not like Ernie's had training in how to be polite.
Yeah.
And how to tolerate. How to suffer fools gladly.
Ernie has had training in how to do triage and how to say things in a small number of words that can be heard over engines to make people stop when they're about to kill everybody else on the boat. So if it feels sometimes like he's coming at you from a little bit of that angle, it's probably because he is.
So when people have workshops and they hire you guys, I think it's important to have the package deal. You know, some people might think, oh, I'm a genius, and so I'm going to just have Ernie come out. And I think those people will end up very sad, if not, you know, injured.
Well, yeah, and Ernie's got a injured leg that also gives him chronic pain, so he sometimes gets short-tempered through no fault of the people around him. We do make a good team because, I'm an explainerator by trade, and Ernie's does a lot more with his hands, and so people can usually find their learning style and what they need to know. Often in a workshop, people will sort of gravitate toward one or the other of us based on what's more effective for them as they're learning.
Yeah.
So now, off of the list that I have of stuff to talk about before we get into the big list, because people have sent in a lot of questions to ask for this podcast, so one of the notes I got is about Legionella. So we listened to Boom Squish last night.
Yes.
Was all the points about Legionella covered well enough in that, or were there things that I left out, or what?
I think that one of the things to remember when you're talking about any kind of bacteria, it's not just Legionella, it could be, you know, botulism, okay, there's a life cycle they go through. They don't breed, they split in half, okay. And that means that every single bacteria that you're talking about is splitting in half every time it goes through its life cycle. So you wind up with what is called an exponential growth pattern, right? Happens on your countertops too. It's an exponential growth pattern. I think that's the part that kind of people lose it. The other thing that that came to mind was many bacteria nowadays are becoming very, very, very resistant to a lot of stuff. Same with hospitals.
Yeah, I've noticed people are not as scared about infections like pneumonia. Like, how many people have lost somebody that died of pneumonia that wasn't also dying of something else at the same time in the last 50 years? It's been something that's treatable. 100 years before that, it wasn't. And we're getting into the point with everybody using the antibacterial soaps and everybody getting penicillin every time they call their doctor. We're running through our arsenal of antibiotics, I think, about as fast as we can come up with new ones. And I think it's worth doing the simple stuff, the public sanitation kind of stuff, to keep that under control rather than going straight to that antibacterial arsenal and using that up and then having to go back to relying only on boiling the water because there's nothing else that works anymore.
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of stuff where people are dying, and it's like Legionella is finishing the job. Like, they were already feeling poorly.
Yeah.
And then that made it so that the Legionella, you know, made things way, way worse, and it was the Legionella that finally did them in.
Yeah, but quite frankly, what they've done is, with all these inoculations and everything else and all these people having such sterile houses and sterile food and sterile everything else, is they basically made it so the human beings that are wandering around don't have an immune system anymore.
Right. There are a couple of things about Legionella that are not common with a lot of the other bacteria that you know, we're talking about at the moment. So Legionella reproduces at a very high temperature,
right,
which is a little unusual, and lives in water. And on top of that, Legionella finds its way inside of you via water vapor, which is a little bit unusual for a lot of bacteria.
And I would even say that's where you guys were talking about water vapor versus steam. I believe what you're actually talking about with Legionella is what we would call aerosols. It's a very fine particle of water that's sprayed out from the shower and that's got whole life, you know, bacteria that can ride along in that tiny little droplet.
Okay.
But
What do you guys
have? I don't know that for sure. It's just a suspicion based on the size of the Legionella.
Your water heater. So at the moment, you're in a brand new place. You just built it. You threw it together a couple of months ago, and you're living in here. And so for at the moment, it looks like you got electric.
We have an electric water heater, and it's set at 180 degrees.
And you set it at 180 because?
Well, I set it at 180 because it purifies the water, and we've got a long pipe to get to our bathroom to take a shower. And since I do my exercises and my physical therapy in the shower every morning, I like to have a nice long shower that's hot.
it's a bigger reservoir of heat because you're mixing it down at the shower head, so you can take. I don't think we've ever managed to take a shower that ran us out of hot water because the heater knows it's got to get working when we start drawing on that hot water.
And how big is that water heater there?
That water heater there is 40 gallons.
40 gallons, all right.
That's pretty normal. I mean, it's like the one in Lamont's apartment, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what this one actually is super insulated.
Okay.
Yeah, so your dad's good with insulation.
Yeah, it's got almost 3 inches of insulation on it.
Okay, all right.
So it uses very little power for what it does.
Okay, so we've talked about people calling. They put together crazy-ass shit, and they're calling it a rocket mass heater. So we've got that covered.
I think we covered that pretty well.
Stop making crazy and calling it rocket mass heater or rocket stove.
So we got the crazy covered.
And then we talked last night at great length about the idea that you guys have plans. In fact, I was looking at them, and wow, that's lovely detail. And that's for your double chamber cob oven.
Yeah, and we've got the same kind of detail on the 8-inch system, the proven 8-inch system that we built for John Young down in California.
Mm-hmm.
That's the suspended one on the wood floor. And then the 6-inch system that we've built in several places. We built an 8-inch system here because we knew it was going to be cold.
Okay. So very detailed plans with a lot of very detailed information is what I saw.
Yeah.
And then another interesting thing is that I know that in the video that I have with you in the double chamber cob oven that you gave credit to Kiko Denzer, and then I talked to Kiko about it, and Kiko said, that's not me. That's all Ernie.
Yes. I keep trying. Kiko taught me how to make ovens. We talked about the design of the oven. So I give credit to Kiko because he's the person that I was talking to that helped me design the oven. But he's like,
no, that's all Ernie, man.
Yeah,
that's all Ernie.
Well, and the idea of putting a chimney on your earthen oven is something that's pretty much standard in commercial, like pizzerias or in Europe. You know, we had a Norwegian pizza baker that came over to work on rocket stoves for a while, and he just was like, people don't know where to get plans for an oven with a chimney. Like, that's a new thing that's been around for a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's, you know, it's a pretty straightforward thing, and the proportions in terms of the heat and the height of the door and stuff like that is based on Kiko's excellent book on.
So I know I've been asked for plans for it like a half dozen times at least, and it's like, you know, but anyway, I know that there's people wanting to put it, but the big thing is, the thing we talked about last night is that you got this available as a PDF.
Right.
And you want to get it rigged up on a website somewhere where it's like $30 to get it. And then you guys were asking me, like, where do we go to set this up? And my response was, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then we started talking about, like, Amazon. So basically, you guys are going to create a thread. So by the time this podcast comes out, there will be a thread in the Meaningless Dribble Forum created about how do we go about doing this.
Right.
And so then, you know, if anybody has information or ideas about how to go about doing this, then by all means, go to that thread.
That actually works.
Oh, yeah, that works. That actually works pretty good because setting up something that doesn't work is easy.
Yes.
Yeah.
We've done that already.
And
quite easy. I've already done that. I spent my $14. It's now $28 for something that I can barely understand.
Okay. So what would be great would be to find something that you can set up that works and is easy.
Yeah.
But you know, because you've already been down easy and doesn't work, or...
Right.
Or doesn't work, not easy.
Super complex, and
yeah,
you know, they're PDFs. I forget how many pages the oven is.
I would say we're looking at a 1 to 2 meg file on these. We've got 3 or 4 pages of illustrations, and then we've got the number of pages of text that take you from like how to make cob if you've never made cob up to how to design your kitchen if you've never baked in an earthen oven.
Right. So. You know, we need something that's easy, that we can put the PDF up, we can have the charge for it, because it's how we make a living. I mean, this is our business.
Right. Well, and plus, clearly, because I know, like, I've had a whole bunch of people ask about, hey, can I get plans for the portable rocket mass heater?
Right.
And I'm kind of thinking, like, you know, in the videos, is it not totally obvious how it's made? And I mean, like, I didn't have plans to work from. I made it all up.
Some people like to make stuff up, and some people really like to have, you know, the elevation and the plan and the section drawing so that you can see, like, what the proportions are and where each brick goes. If you don't have to think about that part, it probably saves you a whole lot of time. You know, Ernie and I are in the kind of, like, we like to mess around with stuff category, and we'll make each manifold differently and be comfortable with that. But knowing how to make one that's going to work, because you know people have made it before and you know that you can get the bricks to fit together without bonking into each other, you know, it's handy. So if you want me to draw yours up that way, I can do that.
So the guy that's in the video with me a lot, Jeff Badnott, and so he loves SketchUp. And so he's a SketchUp fiend. And so he's been sending me SketchUps and sending them to me, and then I look at them and I say, actually, I think the heat riser is much taller. We can go measure it. And so it's in the works, and hopefully we'll get it out fairly soon. But I got the point I'm trying to make now is, it's a lot of work to document this stuff.
Oh,
it's one thing to go out there and make it and get it working, and you're like, I want it rocky, or so I'm going to modify the design now. But it's another thing to then, like, okay, now sit down at a desk and, like, spend 20, 40, 100 hours.
100 hours. I was here while she was drawing it up.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, and for what? And it's like, it's for me, it's like I put the information out there, and then it's like, 100,000 people enjoyed that piece of information that you provided. And now let's take a look at, I've set up this tip the web thing. Now let's take a look at the number of tips you got from it. You got 2 nickels.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, and so I feel a little abused, you know, and so I do think that it's kind of like, I think saying $30 is totally legit.
Well, on these,
we're trying to get somewhere between the people who we know are trying to build a stove for under it $100, but we've also, like, we've paid $80 for a boat plan for a boat that's big enough for a cradle, right? But it's just a really nicely worked out, beautiful little wooden boat plan. We see a lot of, like, the masonry heater code. You pay $45 for an electronic copy of the masonry heater ASTM standard. And so it's just like in the business of making it easy for somebody to build something, that's a pretty much the going rate. We're on the very low end of the going rate for building plans.
Yeah, and then you know, if you have the building plans, here's where it starts getting, where the benefit really starts doing it. No, A, you know you have a system that's going to work. Okay. From brass tacks, you have a system that's going to work. B, you can take those plans, the way they're drawn up, and walk into your code official and hand them the damn plans with dimensions on them.
Which some of these people, it's like, you know, we're not going to allow, we're going to stop you from making this unless you have plans.
Right. That's one of the things that they absolutely want to see.
Yeah.
And they want to see what the clearances are. They want to see all this other stuff, which is what we first started doing the plans for, because we're getting it approved in Portland. We're working on getting it approved in Portland. And one of the things you have to submit for code is a plan with all the dimensions on it. So we're putting out a plan with all the dimensions on it.
Right.
Which makes your code official, when they're trying to approve this, when you're trying to get it approved in your place, makes your code official say, oh, wow, this is cool. And you hand him the rocket stove book at the same time, or send him to Permies, because a lot of them will actually go look it up. They want information. You send it to Permies, you send them to Permies, you hand them the rocket stove book. Now, instead of having an oppositional relationship, you're giving the guy information. You're giving him everything he needs to know.
Right. Bringing them up to speed. More people are learning about it.
Well, and the people who go into code, a lot of them, you know, I mean, the ones we've worked with have all been really kind of cool people, you know. My grandfather went and did code inspections for a while as an electrician. They people who like to make stuff, and they're people who like to look at stuff, and they're people who want to keep people safe. And most people, if you start out thinking they're here to tell you no, then you're going to have kind of an awkward conversation. But if you start out thinking, like, this guy's here to check, and he's an expert, and he's going to bring his expertise and give me some pointers if I've got anything that's going to kill us. You know, you can have a good relationship with somebody that's their job is to go and try to keep people from killing themselves.
And having seen some of the things people talk about on Reddit and on Permies and some other places I've been to, it's kind of like, boy, you know, I can see the need for having a code system, because these people just do seem hell bent on killing themselves in the name of their in the name of their geniusness.
Well, yeah, like they'll put a corrugated pipe, which Eric and I have ragged on this time and time again. Don't use corrugated pipe in your rocket stove.
My all-time favorite was the horizontal heat riser.
That one just is so perfect as an example of what you don't get.
Yeah, and then their question was, why is this not working?
Or somebody who will build the burn tunnel and put a barrel on it but not have any heat riser at all. They just think that somehow if you put the smoke in a barrel, it makes it work better. Because that's all you can see from, like, a one-shot photo. You don't have the interior cross-section or something, and the one thing you saw, it just looked cool. Because, I don't know, maybe some people get off on pickles. I don't know.
You know, I think it's totally, here's another thing, I think it's totally legit that they hire you guys as a consultant to look at their stuff, so that way if their stuff is so bad they don't want to embarrass themselves by posting it out of Permies, that they can get a private consultation to look at their pictures, and then you probably want to get that with Erica. Take my word for it.
If there's anything that seems like it might work but might not, and it's a perfectly reasonable thing to wonder about, then I'll run it by Ernie, and, you know, I've got him in my back pocket, so to speak. But, you know, if there's something,
Ernie!
That, you know, I can see why you're going there, but I can also see that it's been done before, and you should know about that before you ask Ernie that question. I'll let you know.
Okay, so the key is that we're going to get a thread going out at Meaningless Drivel, out of the Permies Forum, to talk about how you guys can get these things up so people pay $30 a pop, and it works well.
Yeah.
And, hey, you know, I'd even like it if it was a system that had some kind of, you know, easy peasy affiliate thing in it, so I could link to it and somehow get money from my empire.
Yeah. We're all about, you know, we do have to eat, but Paul needs to eat too. And even the all pie dinner.
That's right. Last night was an all pie meal. We had pie for dinner and pie for dessert. That was such an awesome meal.
I'm glad you liked it. We had a lot of fun putting it together.
So the next thing I got on my list here is upcoming events. Now, you guys are going to be doing some workshops, right?
Yeah, we're going to be doing a workshop at Yestermorrow. Here, let me have Erica answer this.
Because I keep the calendar in my purse, sir, and I can only see if he asks. Yestermorrow's in Vermont, and we've got a workshop scheduled there in September. I believe it's the middle weekend in September, the weekend that includes the 15th. And then a couple of weeks later, we are still scheduling a workshop in Maine with some folks called the New Forest Institute. And so basically we're doing a little East Coast tour if we got people in New England or close enough that they want to make it worth our while to drive from Vermont or Maine to come and do a site visit or do a little fire science workshop, or, you know, we could probably even throw in another full rocket mass heater build. Now would be a really good time.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What time of year is this going to be happening?
This is September.
Okay,
mid to late September, so we could go into early October for somebody, or we could go early September, and easily you wouldn't be paying for our travel from the West Coast. You'd only be paying for our travel from New England.
Okay. All right. So the New England tour.
The New England tour is very exciting. We might even make it to, what's it called, the Common Ground Fair, the Maine Country Fair it used to be. So if people want to look for us, either doing a demo on the schedule or at the New Forest booth,
you're starting
a great time to come and...
You're starting to get your dance card filled up now.
Yeah, and we'd like to get our dance card filled up clear across the United States so that when we leave here, you know, even if it's just to come look at a rocket stove or give a site evaluation, you know, we're happy to do that. We're going to be traveling across country in a car, so we'd like to be comfortable when we sleep.
make it a little more efficient.
So that we're actually going through and doing the work, because we don't get out to the East Coast very often.
Just doing
extra work across the country means that we're not wasting gas.
Yeah, so we'd like to set something up in the Great Lakes region. I know we've had some people from Michigan and Detroit areas been curious about it, so if they want to try to put together something on our way there or on our way back.
All right.
And we've also got some things coming up in Nevada. We've got a build in Reno that will probably take place in June. We're going to do a little promo demo thing in March if people just want to come get a taste of it. And then... we got some private builds too that I don't want to talk about
where we are.
Launch company.
Yeah. I imagine there's going to be quite a few people where it's like they want it very, like, discretion is very important to them.
Right.
And
we may want to talk to you about setting something up in Montana on our way by on one of those trips as well.
Well, and that reminds me, by the way, that, you know, we've got 11 days of Sepp Holzer going on in the beginning of May, and then there's a PDC just before that. Both of those are full. And there is a waiting list. There is some talk that maybe they'll try and, like, for the 11 days except they might try and find a bigger venue. So if you get on the waiting list, it could actually turn out to come, but it's like it'll be expensive.
Yeah.
There's a fellow that's got a place. I've got a place to stay and everything up there. I'm all set. But outside of that,
and Yestermorrow is already registering for that one in September in Vermont, and I think they're limiting it to about 15 people. They like to keep the hands-on stuff small so people get good attention.
Oh, okay. So then, yeah, folks better line up now.
In Maine is signing people up as well.
All right. Well, I'm sure you guys are probably you probably have a thread out of Permian that has details about all the things that you are currently, you know, setting up or something, right?
I haven't put any details in it. I did put a thread in there saying that we're heading for the East Coast this year.
If somebody asked a question, though, like, what are you guys doing in the Midwest this year? Then you guys would, okay. Because now we have a brand new forum at Permian too.
Right.
That we just created, because you guys
guys said, you know, there's just so much of this. Let's create a new forum. And so now we've got the forum. I think it's called Wood Burning Stoves. Is that right?
Yeah.
And we moved all the rocket mass heater and all the rocket stove stuff in there, and anything about just, you know, wood burning in general in there. And you guys are set up as the moderators of that forum.
Yep.
And so people can come there and they could say, if you're curious about an event that might be going on in your area, that I suggest you ask it this way. Erica, is there something in my neighborhood coming soon? That might be a good way to ask it.
Yeah, you'll actually get the date.
Yeah, the actual date.
Me, you'll get told yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he has large sausage-like fingers, and so he types smaller words. Yeah, and I mean, there's also, we are happy to travel, but we don't tend to go and try to impose something on people. We tend to go to a place where somebody has invited us and is willing to host an event. And we rely on that local person to do things like gathering materials, that we don't want to ship masonry back and forth across the country. That's just silly.
Right. So, but, you know, we got having threads about that kind of thing and that forum is totally legit. Then, of course, going out to ErnieandErica.info can work too, and get it all worked out. Now, back to this. Here's this brand new place that you guys just built. And we're up in the Okanagan Highlands, and right now, and there's been snow outside since October. I know it's mighty cold outside right now, and I know that there's you guys built a rocket mass heater in here. It's an 8-inch system.
Yeah.
And you had, and I was visiting with you about it. You had one fire in it yesterday.
Evening.
Yeah, yesterday evening, early evening, because I know when I arrived that the fire was, like, ending its life.
Yes.
And it was mighty warm in here. In fact, I remember we kept opening the door because it was warm. And then this morning, I'd say right now it feels like 67, 66 in here. We have not built a fire yet.
No.
And there's
and it's 11:55, so we're not going to build a fire for another couple of hours.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's cooling off, but it's not like it's cold in here.
Right.
But it was definitely getting warm last night in here.
Yeah. Well, I was sweating last night. I had to go outside because I couldn't breathe anymore. This 8-inch system can chase you out of the house.
Well, you did run it for a number of hours too.
No, I didn't.
How long did you run it for?
An hour.
Seriously?
Yeah.
I thought you did it
of wood.
When I went to the run.
Yeah.
Okay.
So now, the amount of wood that you used probably would fit into a conventional wood stove with plenty of room to spare.
Yes.
Yeah, and for that, whereas in a conventional wood stove would have eaten it in half an hour, it'd be gone, and then it would be, and then the room would get cold. So basically, over there, I know that I went and felt it this morning. The mass on the rocket mass heater was still quite warm and
yeah,
putting out heat. And if you wanted to, you could sit on the bench and get probably too warm.
Yeah, and sweat.
And sweat. Yeah, if you wanted to have a good sweat, just go sit on that bench for a while.
I have that thing that I think a lot of women have, where my feet get cold if I'm just sitting around, and so I'll sometimes go and curl up on the bench and get my feet warm and then go back to being lazy somewhere else.
So, all right, so now that, I kind of made a quick list this morning of things to talk about before we hit to the list of everybody's questions and stuff. And now we're going to move on to the big list. Let's see if we can get it all covered. So maybe I should have marked these ahead of time. So here's somebody named Curtis Schmidt. What's the smallest and largest size that a rocket heat mass heater could feasibly be? I'd like to make a tiny one for heating a small outdoor workshop without taking up too much space. Thanks.
The smallest one is 6-inch. There's a problem with 4-inch where when you first build it, it's going to work fine until you put the exhaust piping on it. And then what you're dealing with is you don't have enough area for laminar flow to work out in it, and you wind up with a block, and it'll start smoking back.
You got too much drag for your flow, the surface
right,
area of the pipe and the area, cross-sectional area for the flow to go through are pretty much the same, rather than there being a bigger area than you have
right,
surface.
And a 6-inch is really close to where, you know, it's a little bit above, so a 6-inch system will work. The largest feasible system, right? We're not talking about, you know, the max but that you could go, but we're talking about the largest feasible system is a 10-inch system.
And beyond that, you get into temperatures that it's very hard to find materials to make. You got to remember that even our best masonry materials are all made of the same elements, and if you get it hot enough, it melts just like it would in a volcano. You know, you can get these things hot enough to melt perlite, melt rock, and you can do cause some thermal shock that's going to take out like your fire brick and things like that. We're actually starting to look at some of the ceramic refractory materials.
Yeah.
Like we got some cool stuff from Western Industrial Ceramics and Twelton.
Yeah.
It's worth playing with if you're looking to go into bigger systems, but even that, it's going to probably, the flames are going to erode it over time.
Yeah. That's actually something I want to touch on. A lot of people have written me and told me, well, you can't get over 3,200 degrees with wood. Or something around there, 2,700 degrees or something. Anyway.
This is where you say something that sailors usually say?
Yeah. Feel free, Ernie. What do sailors say in this situation? Yeah. Ernie's face is pinching up. He's trying to not. Like, apparently we're not ready to hear what Ernie has to say.
We go to build a rocket mass heater in California, right? We're coming down from Oregon. We're thinking California is warmer. It has beaches, right? But it turns out that their firewood is oak and madrona. Right. Anybody on the East Coast is going to recognize that oak's a pretty dense firewood. Madrona is more so. Madrona burns hotter than oak, and that's the scrub wood that they get in these savannas. And so they are getting temperatures that make interesting colors in the ashes without using any newspaper or anything. They light their fire with a bow drill. And it's just like, wow, you know, I'm glad he decided to go with fire brick. Because you're literally getting temperatures that are sintering and fusing the ash in really interesting ways. Huh. You're getting close to melting temperatures.
Yeah. And those are quite high. We've melted steel with rocket stoves. In fact, that's why we did the research on the 10 and 12 inch systems, is to smelt aluminum. Okay. I don't know what's going on inside the stove yet. I'm really trying to learn why I'm getting temperatures that are so much higher than what wood is supposed to burn at.
So here's a benchmark on the large system. We're going completely the opposite direction from this guy's question about small systems. And, you know, but somebody else had other
questions. I think you answered his question. It's good.
Yeah.
So now go off on whatever tangent you want.
All right. If you're thinking, hey, that brass tack I was going to buy is kind of expensive, I think I'd rather smelt and alloy my own brass and make my own fittings.
Right.
That sounds like it would be cool. And I don't want to pay this guy, you know, $5 for this hinge. If that's your attitude and you have the background knowledge to kind of have an idea in your head how you're going to do that, then playing with a 10 or 12 inch system and monkeying around with the materials you're going to need and whether you need replaceable shielding or stuff like that is probably within your skill set. If you're like, my lamp doesn't work and I don't know if I want the hardware guy to tell me I'm an idiot for wanting to buy a part for it, and that's kind of your approach to material science, is I'd better get a new one because it's electrical, or I'd better get a new one because that sounds like a lot of work, or you know, it's kind of hot and achy, then I probably would stay within the 6 to 8 inch systems.
Yeah, 6 to 8 inch systems for heating your house are totally adequate. The next question is from Matt Arms.
Well, wait. Okay. Before we leave this one, I have a thing to say.
What ties in?
It ties in. It does, doesn't it? Because that's exactly what I was going to talk about. I was going to say, if you've got like a 12,000 square foot house, the idea of having an 18 inch rocket mass heater right in the middle seems seems like a bad idea to me.
I'm laughing. Ernie is covering his face with his hands, which you can't see, but it's just like, yeah. What you want to do, if you've got a 12,000-square-foot house, is you already understand that you are the lord of the manor, and you probably want people in the background that are coming in and making the fire for you while you're still asleep, maybe bringing you your chocolate, right? And so what you want to look
at,
what you want to look at there, and some of our clients are in that kind of area. I'm not going to name names, but you've got a rocket mass heater in the entertainment part of the house that you know, it's nicely plastered, and it has paintings or whatever on it, you know, frescoes and things, and then you have a rocket mass heater that operates in the bathroom and bedroom wall, say, and so when you want to have that guest suite active, then you light that one, and when you're not using that, then you don't need to light that one, but you're starting to look at kind of like the medieval manors would have a fireplace in each room. You're
right, exactly, and see, that's where I was kind of going with it, is like, if you're thinking you're going to have central heat, And you don't have any venting going off of it, you just have it sitting there by itself, then, yeah, that's not going to work out.
Well, if you've got a 5,000-square-foot house, an 8-inch system is not going to heat it, but a 10-inch system also is not going to heat it.
Well, but see, we built the convection into that one in the three-story, three-family house.
Right.
And so you're getting hot air flow up through, and then the house actually has some cool, like, turret-like features that create some draw to pull the heat up into the upper floors.
But you got
it. And then that was in the oak and madrone situation.
Right.
You got some serious heat there, and they're much happier with that than they were with their fireplace or their conventional air forced air heating system with mold in it. And so they're much happier with the rocket mass heater for that purpose. But that's kind of the limit of what you can do with an 8-inch system. They're running that much more than somebody would for a smaller house because they're getting it very hot in order to pump hot air through the rest of the house.
I can make an 8-inch system that will heat a 5,000-square-foot house as long as the house is configured in such a way that will work. But
they're going to run the surface temperature.
They're going to run the surface temperatures up.
Yeah. You're not necessarily going to want to sit on it at the middle of its heating cycle. You're going to want to keep the cushions off and use it as a heater rather than as a bench.
Yeah. So
the answer to this question is the same as almost all questions, which is it depends. It depends on how wonky your house is, how crazy you are, things like that.
Yeah. Now, an 8-inch system for a 2,000-square-foot house, no problem. Okay. It'll heat your back rooms if you plan it right. Putting it as a central heater, not a problem. You just need to configure it correctly to put the heat where you want it.
This is something we run into a little bit, too, is sort of the laws of physics work a certain way. Radiant heat is transmitted line of sight. Convection heat tends to move upward. Contact is really efficient, and if you can build it where you can sit on it or lean against it or raise bread on it, then you're...
Sleep on it.
Yeah, then you're actually getting the heat where you want it rather than putting the heat in the basement and then hoping it reaches you eventually.
Yeah, much like your zone heating that you're doing.
All right. So I just got to point out real quick here that you mentioned the laws of physics. I've been told 20 or 30 times that what you guys are doing is not possible and it doesn't exist in this universe because of the laws of physics.
You have to get into post-Newtonian physics. Like, you have to actually either be able to understand calculus or work with things like thermosiphons to make it work.
Oh, okay.
Right? Like, to understand how it works. You can make it work if you follow the plan and you don't deviate, but to understand how it works, you do need a little bit more monkeying around time where you actually are understanding not just the laws of physics, but how to put them together, like multiple laws of physics at the same time. I mean, it is. It's complicated, and I've got a college degree in it, and Ernie's got 20 years of sea time making things work and putting out engine fires.
And working with superheated steam and air flows in boats and all of these other things. And, you know, how does water flow around a boat? How does it go through a hose? All of these things you have to know.
How well will your pump operate if you have an object of a certain size stuck in it, you know?
Yes.
I think my point was, is most people who say laws, who have the phrase laws of physics on their lips have no fucking idea what the laws of physics are.
Well, they probably have an idea. They just don't know
the details.
For those people, the most important law of physics to remember is, I believe it's the second law of thermodynamics, is the universe proceeds to increasing disorder.
Yeah.
So if you're not sure what you're doing and you're trying to solve a problem, chances are you're going to make it worse. try to solve two problems at once if you possibly can, and then you might get ahead.
So let's go on to the next question here.
Okay, could a rocket mass heater be used to heat my 2,000 foot squared future house, two floors including some hot water? Potentially yes. Again, I tend to recommend if you have never done a plumbing project before and you're thinking about hot water, think about an open tank on top of the barrel rather than trying to think about plumbing your first project in a potentially
a pressurized system. I mean, basically, that comes back to the boom squish, which is, and you guys are validating that what was said in boom squish is accurate.
Yeah.
And that is that a pressurized system, you've got a good chance of killing yourself, your family, maybe even your neighbors. When you combine this information about how to do it correctly with the kind of people we've been seeing a lot of asking questions, then death is imminent. However, with people who actually take the time to really understand this, which means probably not those people who think that they do.
Most people, their experience with hot water systems has been a system that somebody else has designed, lab tested, and someone else has installed for their home. And when they move off the grid for the first time, they remember how good hot water was and they really want it, but they haven't had any experience beyond possibly replacing a hose under their kitchen sink as far as what the plumbing is actually doing in there, with what the safety valves are that are built into their water heater and stuff like that. So if the people we tend to talk to about the details are people with things like boilermaker certificates, people like your friend that installs water heaters for people like solar water heaters, and that's what he does like 3-4 times a week. And so if you've got that kind of handy experience with pressurized systems and you know what the temperature ranges are you can work to, and you know water's weird.
You know about the explodey, squishy part.
How water heats up and when it flashes to steam is something that's kind of hard to predict. What happens if you get a bubble in a system, and which kinds of systems will be able to pump past that, and which kinds of systems are going to get blocked up if you get a bubble. And
it just blows the hell up.
And steam is a bubble that's trying to expand very rapidly. You know, so think seriously about what the experience level is of the people you've trusted up to this point with your hot water system before you think about whether you want to be the person who does that for yourself this time.
Right. Yeah. It could be the last thing you ever do.
Right. And when it comes down to your house, give me a freaking call. Okay? I'll walk you through it. Pay the little bit of money that it takes to get the consultation, for God's sakes, and we'll design the system. But don't... You know, if you're not absolutely sure of what you're doing, don't do it yourself. You know, there's no problem asking for help.
Yeah, the other thing I might put out there is if you are, what was your friend's name?
Caleb.
If you're Caleb or somebody like him and you would like to think seriously about getting good enough at rocket mass heater water heating to help people install it, because you're already helping people install solar water heaters or other off-the-grid options, you know, a backup generator with an electric water heater, you know. We'd love to work with some people that already have that background knowledge and build a group of people you could call that will come and install it. Ernie and I teach. We don't tend to build things for people. As a rule, we're not that kind of contractor. And there's reasons for that, but I'd love to.
The big one is there's so much going on in innovation and that space. So,
right.
But I mean, like, you guys are busy with coming up with the new stuff. All right, so then this guy's got more to his question here.
Okay, so could it be used to heat a 2,000 square foot, 2-foot floor house, including some hot water? Yes to everything, with the caveat that the hot water is going to be the trickiest part. Best ways to eliminate smoke back in rocket mass heaters.
Build it right.
There you go.
There's a lot of people who claim to be experts in this field who seem to be experts at making systems that smoke back.
Yep. And that you get when you're pushing the limits of how much heat you can pull off the system and how cold you can make your exhaust as it goes out the house. It's an interesting theoretical problem. We don't tend to push those limits on our systems.
Not the ones we build for people.
Well, and not the ones we build for ourselves.
Right.
If you want to build one in a workshop outside in a sand pit and just see how far you can take it and when it starts to smoke back, that's very useful information. But we don't tend to go to that outer limit when we're building something that we know we want it to work, not just in the middle of January, but we want it to work in, you know,
June,
May, if it gets cold and you just want a fire. So make sure it's got enough draft. Your draft is coming from your heat riser and potentially from a second warm chimney if you make a vertical exhaust chimney. If you make a cold vertical exhaust chimney, that's going to hurt you. If you make a short heat riser, that's going to hurt you. That's the summary.
I think, you know, getting a longer heat riser is going to solve almost everything.
And
you have more slot factor in other places.
Yep.
Right.
Do not push it on drag. Don't put rough surfaces in your heat exchanger or corrugated. And do not push it on air intakes. People often want to add a secondary air intake, and if you give it two ways to suck air in, it's going to suck air in one and push smoke out the other.
Right. And I'm not sure if there's a question about that, but I do think that the whole air, you know, getting your air from the outside thing is a thing. And did we cover that in the previous podcast?
Well, you and I have a topic about secondary air for wood-burning devices in general that, like, it's just been you and me and this one other guy talking about it for the last year.
In a thread on Permies,
and there's some really good information there. I just went back there and put another thing up that I've been hearing about. That, you know,
is that one where I was talking about breathing in your own farts and stuff? And,
yes.
And you were calling it poetry or something?
Poetry.
I can't remember what I called it, but yeah, no, it's just like there's a number of reasons that you might want outside air, and you might. There's ways to do it that are safe, and there's ways to do it that can give you more problems. And I didn't really address the rocket mass heater thing, but if somebody wants to know about it, that would be a great place to talk about it. What are the best ways to keep rocket mass heater clean with minimal maintenance? I like to wash mine with a damp rag. Literally, I just washed the clay off the rock, so we might take a picture of this one while you're here. And then when we get one, we're actually going to patent this and sell it on our website. We mostly just use our hand to scoop the ash out of the burn tunnel on a regular basis. But the little metal scoops that you get at the store for your kitty litter box, what we're going to do, and I'm just telling you about this ahead of time, of course, you know, if I don't get it patented in the next 7 weeks, then you're free to make it on your own, right? you take the kitty litter scoop that's about the right width for your stove, and you bend the head down a little bit so that, and you bend the handle a little bit so that it makes kind of a crookedy S-shape kind of thing, and then you can fit it in there, you can scrape the ash forward, you can turn it and pull it out like a little ladle.
I always use shop vac.
Oh, yeah, for cleaning out the tubes, a shop vac with an extra hose on it works great, or if you want, I mean, we talked to some chimney sweeps, and they have these giant vacuum trucks that they can pull up to your house and hook up to all the orifices of your system and suck all the goop out of your system. These don't put a lot of goop in, but they will put a little bit of fly ash in the pipes.
Yeah, I mean, easy maintenance. How much easier maintenance do you want from clean it once a year, like you do any other stove, clean out the pipes once a year, and reach in every day and pull out the little bit of ash and put it in your ash can?
Are you doing that every day on ours at this point?
No, I cleaned ours out twice so far.
I've cleaned out the fire pit once in the last 2 weeks.
Yes.
Have you done it in the last 2 weeks?
No.
Okay, so technically we encourage people to get in the habit of cleaning their fire pit out every day as they light the fire, but in practice you can go for a while. Yeah, no, it's just if you don't have that habit and then your stove starts slowing down, you're going to like wonder what happened and start taking things apart, when really what you just need to do is I'll sometimes use a little cardboard box that I have there ready to use it as kindling, but I'll just kind of pull it out, put it in a metal bucket, just like you would with wood stove.
So now, from all the interviews I've done and visiting with all the different people and whatnot, my impression is that if you don't build a is that for me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you, sir. Is that if you have a little pit at the bottom of your wood feed, that
We're getting into the makes Ernie say things again.
Yeah, Ernie's over there cursing at me already. But this is what I've heard. If you have the little pit, then you're pulling out the ash about once a week. If you don't have a little pit, then you're pulling the ash out about once a day, you know, or whenever, you know, whenever you're about to start a fire.
I would say it's about the same, really. I mean, I can do it once a week on one without a pit. The reason for the pit, the only good reason I've seen for that, beyond that it's kind of fun and people like it, because they like adding things that don't necessarily have to be there because it makes them feel smart.
Okay.
But if that's not your main reason for doing things, the only reason I've seen that they sometimes work well is in the situation that Yanto's in, where he's in a rainforest that grows mostly conifers for fuel wood. You've got a real soft wood, and they're often burning fairly wet wood, even if they've got it undercover in their wood pile. It's still, the air is saturated.
Even alder is pretty wet.
Yeah, and so you've got some fairly wet firewood that's just kind of how it has to be. You can bring it into the house and dry it out some more, but you're still using wetter firewood than somebody in a snowy climate is going to be using because there's more water in the air.
Yeah.
In that situation, sometimes having it be possible to get a little longer firewood in down under the lip of the burn tunnel without it sticking up is going to be helpful because that wet firewood is going to dry out on the outside first. You're going to burn off the outside of the wood before the bottom of it is burned through enough to drop down and feed properly.
Right.
So that a little extra depth, you can sometimes squeeze in a little extra depth in one place and you don't have to dig your whole foundation deeper.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I've seen where I might consider putting that in the situation where Yanto developed it, which is in that kind of a rainforesty firewood situation.
Next question.
Okay, not sure if this has been covered, but how safe are they to use around babies and small children? Pets.
Okay. All right.
We like this question.
Oh.
There's a famous saying about how people can become overcautious, which is from the wood stove days, and it goes, a cat who has ever once jumped on a hot wood stove will never jump on a cold wood stove again. Right? And my experience has been most of the people in most of the houses I visited are at least as smart as a cat. There are situations where you've got somebody who is going through dementia or you've got a really active, large, young baby that you're really large, like they can reach up above 2 feet on their own, where you might potentially have somebody who's not a human being that's not intelligent enough to keep themselves safe around a thing where it's got a hot, like wood stove temperature thing up at about 4 foot. The top third of the barrel will tend to be the same temperature as an iron wood stove. The lower part of the barrel tends to be a much lower temperature, so you can actually touch it for a couple of seconds and then be like, oh, that's hot. How does my arm work again? Oh, I'll take it off now. If you can actually touch it without getting burned, or you know, you can hold your hand on there for a couple of seconds without getting a blister, that's within the capacity of most young children to figure that out for themselves. It does have a burn feed tube that you can drop things in. One of our client's son, who's 3, every morning comes and brings an offering to the rocket stove, usually one of his own toys. He'll drop like one Lego in the rocket stove or one little toy car or something, like, because his dad feeds the rocket stove all the time, right? And so he's figured out that this is a thing that burns things, and he doesn't like pile the toys in there. He'll just drop one little thing in, and it's, you know, it's a little bit like, ooh, he could get in trouble that way if he puts the wrong thing in there, but they don't give the kid gasoline to play with, so there's a limit to one Lego. It's not, I mean, you might get a little smoke out of it for a while, but it is eventually going to burn up, you know. So I guess if you're used to having your kid around while you cook or stuff like that, I mean, I've met 5-year-olds that could use a kitchen knife, and I've met 12-year-olds that's parents take the sharp things away from them.
Well, Anna and Lily, when they came over,
probably not a good idea to use names.
Yeah.
I won't use their last name, but my name is Lily. We've got two little nieces that come over, and they feed the stove. And you can stick your hand 5 inches down the feed tube without getting hot.
You get to the 6-inch and it's really hot.
Right. You get there on 6 inches and it gets really hot. But you know, for a little one, they have to be about 33 inches have to be able to reach about 33 inches before they're in a place that's dangerous enough to actually burn them before they can pull their hand back.
I would say it's much safer than most wood stoves or fireplaces as far as that aspect goes of the kid being able to touch something accidentally or fall against something accidentally. I've watched, like I was sitting at Timberline Lodge up at Mount Hood, sitting by the fire just for a full day, just to give myself a day off up there, and I watched family after family come in their ski clothes or their little, you know, coming up in their cars, and their little toddlers walking straight toward the fireplace because it's glowing and flickering and beautiful. And you know, the mom or the dad comes, you know, it's like this little bird-like flocking behavior. The toddler comes running toward the fireplace, and the mom or dad comes swooping down from behind and redirects them toward the restaurant. And it's just like this happens again and again and again. It's a passion that little kids have. And if they're never allowed to touch the fire, they're never allowed to touch the hot thing, they're going to continue to have that passion and that fascination. And by the time they're 7 or 8, you're going to have to deal with whether they're playing with matches, right? And so having something around where they can touch and get that it's hot, and the taller they get, the hotter it is when they touch it because they're getting up toward the hot part of the barrel. And they can learn at their own pace that this is something that, while it's fascinating, it's also dangerous, and they want to be careful around it.
Yeah. So, it's quite safe around toddlers.
It's safer. I mean, if nothing else, it's safer than a conventional wood stove.
It's safer than, I would say it's safer than a wood stove, and it's definitely safer than a fireplace with toddlers around.
Yeah.
And I'd also say your biggest point of child and toddler safety is let them touch hot things that you know are not going to kill them as early as possible, so that they start being smart about that themselves, and you don't need to be quite as vigilant. You're still going to want to watch a toddler, of course, but start, you know, don't, if you train your kid to be safe by never letting them experience danger, then you got to deal with a teenager that really, really has this craving for risk.
That burns your house down.
Yeah. So, in.
All right, next question.
I would like to know about converting an existing fireplace to a rocket mass heater. Is it feasible? And if not, why? Thanks, Ananda.
Fortunately, I have that video about that.
Yeah. I have a number of times worked with people where the fireplace actually has two flues. It used to have a wood stove or a kitchen stove hooked up to it, and so there's a capped flue on the same chimney. You've actually got a chimney that's ready to go, and you don't need to build or install a wood stove-type, you know, metal chimney. Those are really nice situations to work in, and you can use the masonry mass of the existing fireplace chimney as part of your heat sink for the building. So that's definitely doable. Trying to hook the ducting up through the mouth of an existing fireplace is doable, but it's going to be ugly. Frankly, if you like being able to open that fireplace up and see the fire and enjoy that,
yeah, that ain't going to happen.
I would think seriously about keeping the fireplace as an entertainment feature and putting the rocket mass heater in another location where you're going to get good heat out of it. And it's not that hard to put another manufactured chimney through your roof or a side vent out, like a dryer vent for your rocket mass heater.
And if you've got a fireplace that's one of the old ox cooker fireplaces that's square, doesn't put any heat into the room, talk to us about Rumford fireplaces. They take not very much work to put one in, and they'll heat your house.
Yeah, you can get, and that's the thing is the, a lot of people want wood heat in an occasional use building, like they're there for the weekend. And if you do a mass heater, a masonry heater, or a rocket stove, rocket mass heater in that context, you're going to be disappointed with the results because you're not going to get most of the heat. You're going to spend a lot of time heating that mass up. And by the time it's up to working temperature, you're off to work or you're off to your rest of your life. So it's worth knowing about the really efficient fireplaces or the efficient wood stoves for something that's going to be a quick heat up, quick rich reward, entertainment value, and then you go away and you're not leaving the building with a lot of heat in it that you've stored for no purpose.
Well, I know that when you guys do your workshops, that a big part of it for the first evening, like your workshops typically start on Friday night.
Right.
And then you got fire science, hours and hours of bizarre things that you watch, and it's like, and the Rumford is a big part of it. And I remember
that we sat in a big oval, and I was far away from the fire, and I was thinking, it's a cold night in January, and damn it, I'm going to be freezing my nubs off because I didn't get here soon enough to be close to the fire. These other people got to sit next to the fire. And then you fire up the Rumford, and the amazing thing is you have a campfire outside, and the people farthest away from the fire are the people that are actually the warmest. And as bizarre as
it sounds, they're not the warmest. They're just
right in front
they're
of the
really
of the
warm.
People and, right in front of the middle of the fireplace are actually quite a bit warmer than you.
And then the other thing is nobody gets smoke in their eyes. You're outside for a campfire, nobody gets smoke in their eyes. And then I remember that, like, we're watching the fire, and then everybody was asked to go and put their hand over the fire, which is totally obvious. Everybody is going to now sacrifice their hand to the fire gods. And it's like, and it was snowing.
Yeah.
And I remember that when you hold your hand over the fire, and it's your turn to sacrifice your hand to the fire gods, then it's like it felt like 70 degrees or so, and it's like that is so bizarre.
Yeah, no, Ernie's got a great story, which I'm going to abbreviate for you, about him and Yanto trying to get a pot of beans to cook over the Rumford fireplace while they're out doing something and coming back like 4 hours later and 6 hours later and like they're just not reheating their beans over the fire, and they finally figured out that it's because this was the Rumford fireplace, so they stuck the beans in front of the fire for the last, 30 minutes? And
yeah.
Then they had hot beans.
And then they had hot beans.
But yeah,
okay.
They're just really smart use of radiant heat. Most of the big box-shaped fireplaces are designed so you can watch a fire without actually having it in your house.
Right.
And if you want to watch a fire looking at the Rumford design, you can usually fit a Rumford retrofit into an existing box fireplace. You don't even have to use mortar if you don't want to. You know, we did this in a rental that we had, and it just had it in there for a few months. It was awesome.
Well, I remember a couple of times I tried to make video of fire science, and it just doesn't turn out.
You got
to
be there.
And so you really got to be there, and it's like, I'm surprised that you guys don't have, like, a workshop going every other weekend, and people, you know, like 100 people wanting to be in on it, because it is. I mean, that's like such an important part of being able to understand how a rocket mass heater works, because it is totally different from a conventional wood stove that everybody's used to. It's just everything works so different. Oh, and before I forget, I heard somebody say something that I thought was brilliant, and it was probably totally an accident, but they said a rocket mass heater or a rocket stove is designed to have a chimney fire for the whole burn.
Yes.
That's the whole thing, is to have a chimney fire. Because people go, oh, no, you can't do that. You're going to have a chimney fire. And it's like, no, this is the idea. You want to build a chimney fire. That's what makes the whole thing work. It's a prolonged chimney fire on purpose.
Yeah.
And you build a very nice, short, insulated chimney that's perfectly designed to take that and is capped in a way that it's not in contact with any of your building. And your flame path goes up the first, you know, the four-foot heat riser that is essentially acting like the first 4 feet of a chimney. The wood stove manufacturers have the darndest time trying to make a wood stove that will be safe to use if this happens once. But generally, the materials they're using and the degree to which they're exposed to the person in the house means if you get your stove red hot, if you get your chimney red hot, your owner's manual says, don't use it again. Replace the parts or have it inspected. Because, frankly, sheet metal is not designed to deal with that.
Right. So, now, have you guys ever, when I say it, it's obvious that that's exactly what's going on. I had just never heard anybody say that before. And so somebody on Reddit said it's a planned chimney fire for the whole burn.
Yeah, for the whole burn.
But now, have you guys ever expressed it that way or heard it?
No, I haven't.
That's exactly what it is.
I try not to alarm people mostly when I'm talking to them.
I think it's a brilliant thing.
Yeah.
It's a controlled chimney fire.
Yep.
That's what we're trying to create. That's what it all is.
And the building industry is trying to make it, like, they only sell stovepipe in short sections anymore and stuff like that. There are a lot of things that are in the code now that are designed to make it so that just in case, we're going to assume you're going to have a chimney fire at some point, and just in case, we're going to make it so that this can keep your house safe while that happens. But this is sort of makes it so that the burn has already taken care of that creosote and stuff, and you don't have to
Well, I think another thing is like if you're going to have – if you have a conventional wood stove and you have a chimney fire, you know, granted, A, your house burns down, which is kind of a drag. But B, think of all that energy and heat that was wasted.
Exactly.
Right. All the times you weren't having the chimney fire, all of that energy was going out the house of smoke.
Well, or when you're having the chimney fire, it's like too bad you couldn't, like, you know, have had
to
harness that heat and use it for something useful.
You know, amortize that heat over time.
yeah, exactly.
So, let's see. I think that's probably thoroughly answered the question of converting an existing fireplace to a rocket mass heater. Let's move on to the next one.
Okay, on to the next one. All right.
Fred says, I'd like a discussion on rocket cook stoves, particularly the construction details for one that will last for a long time. From what I've read about them, the rocket cook stove made out of number 10 tin cans don't last very long before they rust out. And again, they only take around 20 minutes to make and are dirt cheap, literally if you use sand clay dirt that you find nearby as the insulator. Rocket cook stoves that last for a long time. There's our version of this, and there's a million other people's versions of this out on the internet.
Right.
I would say if you really want to construct one that will last for a long time, think about using
masonry.
Yeah, masonry components, and that can be cob. It can be dirt cheap if you've got the right soils locally. You can literally dig a hole in the ground and make one that'll last for a long time. Look at fox stoves as a way that this is done literally in a badger hole or a fox hole in the ground. And if the cob will handle all of the jobs and you can plaster it and repair it in the same amount of time it would take you to get another number tin can and make that work.
Right. Although I think it's getting harder to get a lot of tin cans, especially if you move into a proper homesteading mode, you're not using tin cans.
Yep. Well, and again, it's not technically a tin can. It's a steel can, and the steel will take the temperatures where aluminum wouldn't and tin wouldn't. And so, you know, and good steel is not necessarily being used for cans as much anymore as it used to be because there's lots of things we want to do.
Now they line them with plastic.
Yeah. That'll burn out, though, eventually.
No, I'm not giving construction details. If you want construction details on one, ask me on Permies in the general forum. Remind me, and I will write out construction details, but I'm just not going to do it on a podcast, sorry.
Yeah, no, we did a tea stove for kindergarten out of this refractory stuff that's a portable thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd love to let them use it for a year and make sure that it's doing what we think it's going to do and then maybe put that as one of the plans that we can offer. But
all right. Mr. Lewis Brown, aside from cost and construction, how is a rocket heater different from a good catalytic converter-equipped wood stove? Can the catalytic converters play any role in a rocket heater?
Catalytic converters are the part they stick in a wood stove to make it temporarily cleaner so it can pass the EPA tests and be sold to the unsuspecting public. Most of the catalytic converters we've seen need to be replaced about every 5 years. People
and they cost $5,000.
Well, not quite that much, all of them, but
I think this must be a sensitive issue for Ernie.
I mean, because
he's stomping off to the other side of the room.
He you know, likes to walk and talk, but
mm-hmm.
Or walk and grump. Anyway.
He's going to go do something else for a while now.
The catalytic converter is not needed on the rocket mass heater because it uses time, temperature, and turbulence. To steal Pedro Mianto's book, it uses the shape and configuration, the textures of the burn tunnel and heat riser to completely burn the fuel on its first pass. There's no need to be trying to suck particulate out and get it to start burning again or try to keep the fire alive beyond the top of the barrel. If you really like catalytic converters and you really want a way to play with them well using something that has the word rocket in it, I would recommend that you try making
a rocket
cook stove or pocket rocket, where you put the catalytic converter in the top of the rocket cook stove as part of your pot rest setup, because those will put out a little bit of smoke as the top of the flame path hits a cold pot. And so having a catalytic converter right underneath that cold pot to make sure it's hot gas and not smoke that's hitting that cold pot could be a really useful experiment. And if you do that, please post pictures on friendlies.com.
Okay.
Is that anything you wanted to add to catalytic converters or any amount now that you've recovered your temper?
Nothing other than the fact they're used as a total lie in the wood stove industry. You spend $2,000 for a super efficient wood stove. 5 years later, you got to spend $1,000 to $5,000 to replace the stinking catalytic converter.
Where it's no longer a super efficient wood stove.
Right. And it's basically just it's not for efficiency or anything else. It's to clean an inefficient burn up to make it look efficient.
Can I quote myself?
Yes.
The process of trying to find the most efficient wood stove to heat a house is a lot like the process of trying to decide which barbecue grill is going to be the most efficient way to heat your house. It's an object that's designed for portability, so it can be moved to a lab and tested and then shipped to your house. So it's a low weight. Ernie, would you knock that off?
Yes.
Thank you. It's a low weight brazier. It's a metal object to put a flame in, so you can create a fire in any part of an existing house without having to do a lot of the planning and foundations that it would take to get masonry heater in there.
So here's the thing I want to add to that, and that is that I believe that with the conventional wood stoves, they've been pretty much optimized about as much as they're ever going to get optimized. There might be a little bit of room space in there, but not a hell of a lot. On the other hand, I think rocket mass heaters are already royally kicking their asses. And on top of that, I think that there is an enormous ocean of growth space for making it even more efficient. So at the moment, we're seeing a lot of people reporting that they're able to heat their homes with 5 to 10 times less wood. I think that in the next 10 years, we can see that shift to 10 to 20 times less wood, maybe even get to the point where it's 20 to 40 times less wood.
But to do that, we've got to get people to the point where they're willing to actually sit on the bench they built. Rather than trying to heat the corner of the house over here where they like to sit from the garage over there where they don't have to have bark in the house. You know, like that, the mentality that I want it all on a push button and I don't want to have to look at it. One of the things we used to get a lot that we're, thank God, not getting very much anymore is this idea. I want to build this, but what I want to do is I want to put the wood feed outside and the barrel inside so I get all the heat but none of the yuck. Right? And if you do that, it will smoke. The fire will not run properly because you're
air pressure differences.
It's the burn tunnel. If you make a really long horizontal path, there's no way you're going to make enough heat riser to suck air through that long horizontal path. You created a really smoky ancient furnace. And you can't get into it to put the wood in the middle of the path. You got to load the wood from the end. And then you run into problems with they want to frame that wall up in something flammable. You know, they want to do stud frame or they want to do straw bale or something with a burn tunnel going through it.
Or they want to put the burn tunnel on the outside of the greenhouse.
And the barrel on the inside, and they've got greenhouse plastic on the wall. And it's just like,
I think the important thing is that the conventional wood stoves are they're pretty much capping out. I mean, like over the next 20 years, they might squeeze out 1 to 5% more efficiency in the conventional wood. You don't think they'd even get that much?
No, because their stack temperatures mandatorily have to be so high.
Well, and then at the same time, I really kind of feel like there's massive growth to be had still. I mean, this is just the beginning.
Yes.
We're just getting started. And so what would happen if, like, some company got started up where they could make 1 million of these per year? And then they had a team of 50 people optimizing the design. I think that there could be some really shockingly incredible things that we haven't even thought of yet, the three of us sitting here in this room.
Yeah.
And,
well, I mean,
I'm just really taking a lot of license, including myself. but I am holding the contraption.
this is what we've needed. Ernie and I love coming up with stuff and making it work, but the how to get it out to people, the marketing thing, like you were talking about, have you mentioned this on the forums yet? Well, no, it didn't occur to us to put the dates on the forums yet, but we should do that, huh?
Yeah.
We should tell people when the workshop is, and then they might come, huh? You know, we can be pretty stupid about that stuff. But, yeah, we have some people, like the fellow Neil that we're going down to work with in Reno has a team of, you know, it's three.
Neil Bertrando?
Uh-huh.
Neil Bertrando.
He's got a team of 3 to 5 people that want to be building Cobb ovens and helping them do the key line earth shaping stuff and so on. They kind of want to get an earthworks company going, and they're interested in learning rocket mass heaters. They're just starting to look into that right now. I wouldn't necessarily hire them today to build your rocket mass heater till after we've taught them how to do it. But, but yeah, I mean, it's a viable thing that people can do. I'd love to train up about a dozen people in different regions to where they can reliably put one in and tell the client no when the client wants something that's not going to work.
Yeah.
And just be able to build it for people. We can get it into the homes of some of the elders that maybe have done enough of their share of digging in the dirt and they want to take a break and don't want to throw their back out one more time.
Right.
You know, get some people out there who are making some money putting these things in for people.
Right.
Be awesome.
Right.
Yeah.
Next question.
Could you detail the best method if someone wanted to build one outside, test it, then disassemble it and reassemble it somewhere else? I would love to encourage that as much as possible. That is an excellent plan. Basically, you build it just like you would inside the house, but you don't mortar it, right? You don't put mortar on it. You put just enough cob on. If you're making a cob manifold, you just put just enough cob on to seal it.
Hey, mortar, that's brick glue, right?
Mortar is not brick glue. Mortar is little teeny wedges that keep the bricks apart so that they stay level. You don't need mortar.
I was baiting Ernie. Ernie got so mad.
Ernie just walked away again.
He just had to walk away.
Yeah, but it's luckily, see, this is what I do. I'm a repeater of the things Ernie's already said more than enough times. So yeah, you lay it out. You lay all your pipes out. I wouldn't use duct tape as such, but they make a foil tape for high temperature ducting, and you can put that on there if you want to seal it, like if you're working in your garage and you don't want to smoke yourself out. But build it as close to the configuration you're going to build as you can, so that you know that it's got enough draw to push through the pipes and so on. There'll be small differences. The pipes won't necessarily stay the same temperature that they will when the mass is on there. They'll be hotter at certain points, and they'll be colder at certain points than they would be in the final version, but you get pretty close. And if you put a lot of wet cob around it when you first install it and you test fire it at that point, if it works when it's cold and wet, it's definitely going to work when it's warm and dry. So it makes a good kind of worst case. If I came back to my house in a freak snowstorm in April and my stove was colder than the outside air, but I'm too cold and I want to light my stove, that's when you really want it to work for you.
And that's where you want a robust system.
Yeah. Does that seem to answer the question of building it outside, testing it, disassembling it, and reassembling it? I mean, you've got one that's designed to be built in a box and moved around.
Right.
So that's
right.
Another version, if you want.
But it does seem like that's the norm for most people, is to build it outside, and it does make a big difference, because I know that when we first started doing the one that was built for the box, we built it outside, and we modified it like 6 times.
Yep.
Until we finally got a design that we liked, and then we numbered all the bricks. We just had a Sharpie, and we wrote right on the bricks, numbered them all, and then we rebuilt it inside. And by inside, it was inside a garage.
Right.
You know, but then we ended up shit-canning that whole design, and we went with the whole thing where the heat riser goes all the way to the ground.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which then it's like building, stacking the bricks next to it was just silly. There was no point.
Right.
You know, pretty much all you're trying to do is just make a wood feed out of bricks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The two things that we tend to do in workshops to keep it simple, because remember, we're not doing this just because ourselves we know how to do it. We're trying to get a dozen people who've never seen one before to build one successfully in less than 2 days. Right. So some tools that we've added to our process to help people do that. We encourage the person who loves to hide behind their camera to take pictures as we go along building it outside. And then there's something you can refer to if somebody screws up where the bricks are and they can't find it and they didn't put numbers on them. They can figure out most bricks are the same size as each other.
Right.
Hello?
So that way you have a picture of it and you can reconstruct it later.
Yep. Paul turned his phone off for this conversation.
Ernie wants to talk to somebody else right now, or he could probably use a little levity at the moment.
It is okay. So the other thing that we've done that works really well is after you get your measurements figured out, like there's a width of burn tunnel that you want to make, and there's a length that you want to make it so it matches with the heat riser and stuff like that. You write that down. You'll figure that out once and you write it down. But it can be much easier to build it if you make like a paper template and you just line everything up, or like a little cardboard or wood spacer that you just keep putting between the bricks. So you don't want to be using the tape measure all the time if you can make yourself a physical form or template that you can refer to. Just speeds things up a huge amount.
Okay.
And you don't have to remember which way is 7 1/4 and which way is 7 1/2. You just make a cardboard cutout and you put the front on it with an arrow.
See, I want my new innovation to be the primary way that everybody makes all rocket mass heaters from here on out. But
I mean, it's,
but I also want to win the lottery and I want more pie.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to burst your bubble on that one. Then make the kit and number the bricks and send it to people is something that the masonry heater industry has already done.
Oh, no, no. See, basically the whole idea of having the heat riser go all the way to the ground.
Oh, okay.
And then you just have some bricks that you add on to make the wood feed. No. So basically right now the thing is that people are making the core out of bricks. And what I'm saying is that I think I've innovated something that's so kick-ass awesome that I think that the standard for the rocket mass heater should be to have a heat riser that goes all the way to the ground, and that we no longer do the style where the heat riser is put on top of a brick core.
I think you could actually do a really tidy one with the ceramic flue liner that they use for masonry heaters and chimneys if you have the tools to carefully cut a notch out of the bottom of each one so you can get the sides to talk to each other, or you get elbows. But at present, most of the people we work with tend to be the, like, whack it with a rock people rather than the, like, I have a masonry saw that has a water-cooled blade people. and so getting that corner cut off without creating fractures that are going to propagate and break your ceramic tube later on, it's not within the tool set of many of the people we work with.
And effectively, if you build your heat riser out of brick...
Oh, yeah, if you build your heat riser out of brick, then the whole thing out of brick is better.
Yeah, well, and it gives you good heat retention. There are ways that makes it more like a masonry heater. It's going to be a higher-end, longer-lasting, more durable object. And so a lot of people who, not a lot of Americans, but a lot of people worldwide in general, want something that's going to be durable and it's going to be a multi-generation investment. We want something we can move in 10 years and take it with us.
Right. So when it comes to to address a little bit of that for your famous invention, when it comes to the metal heat risers and things, I developed them so that people could have stoves that lit quickly. Right? They're not the most durable way to do it. They're the fastest way to do it. Big difference.
Real good for people doing a rocket mass heater for the first time.
Right, but if you're going to put it in your house, that it's going to be there for 20 years, use bricks.
So this one's a good one to put in your house that's going to be there for 7 years.
Right.
And so, like, here, you came here, like, for a lot of people, if they do exactly what you just did this last fall.
Right.
You built this house in just a couple of months, and then when you threw in a rocket mass heater, you did a first class one because you've built 700 of them.
Yeah.
But I mean, other people could say, okay, I'm throwing this house together, and the snow's about to fly. I need to put in something to heat the place.
Right.
My design might be better, and it's like, you know, the default design that I'm seeing a lot of is where you have a bunch of bricks that define the core.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make something out of a couple of pieces of duct that are the heat riser that sits on top of that. And all I'm saying is that, and that right now is the default design.
Exactly.
And what all I'm saying is I think that the new default design should use my thing where the heat riser goes all the way to the ground, and then you use just enough bricks to define the wood tunnel and the first couple of inches of the burn tunnel. So they got the wood feed, the burn tunnel, just going up to that.
Right.
Okay, so you agree with what I'm saying?
Well, as long as you have the tools to cut the tin.
Which you're going to have in order to make it out of tin anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
I would say that is probably your optimum for a portable or quick install design. I'm going to also say that we're going to keep teaching the build the brick box and put a heat riser on top of it design, because four courses of bricks is about the optimum to teach a crew of 12 people who have never handled a brick before how to plumb and level a brick if they want to build a permanent version.
Okay.
Getting a crew of 12 people who have never touched a brick before to plumb and level a 4-foot, 1-brick thick column. Not practical in a weekend workshop, but that there's reasons for why we do it the way we do to teach people the skills they need.
Okay, so then the stuff that I'm advocating, the thing I'm advocating at the moment, could be the fastest path for somebody to get from zero to rocket mass heater.
Yeah. So if you want to build one to play with, if you want to build,
one. I want people to build one that'll last them 7 winters.
Right.
And then while they're using it for 7 winters, they can plot and scheme and think about their dreamy ultimate thing that's going to last them 20 winters.
Right. I would say I would make a bet that it'll last them at least 2 winters on the metal heat riser that with a hole cut in it. If they, depending on what kind of firewood they have and how long they burn it, I've seen the metal heat risers either flake out and burn the metal out if they use a lightweight ducting, or on a steel triple wall metal bestus, I've seen it, the inside expand so much that it put a kink in the inside of the thing. So that, I mean, metal is not the optimal material for a durable all-winter heater for a multi-year investment, but it works great for a proof of concept, and it would work pretty darn well for something that's going to be portable and something like, that's why wood stoves are metal, right? But you line them with fire brick to get them to work properly and to extend the life of the metal.
Okay. All right. That's very good. Next question.
I'm curious if anyone has ever modeled a rocket stove in a computer simulation. I'd also like to know if anyone has ever added cooling fins to the heat exchange barrel in order to keep the barrel cooler, possibly increasing the airspeed inside the system. Singles for a blower motor at the exhaust end to pull the air faster. Just curious if such testing has ever been done with these systems.
Okay, on the computer simulation.
Mr. Drew's really into the rocket.
Let's see, Drew Mimis.
Don't give her their last name.
Drew M. Smith.
No, if they put their last name in this thing here, they know that it's going to be, I mean, this is a thing that says for the podcast.
Okay, and so it says Drew Smith, which might not actually be his real name, so that's okay.
Okay, as far as the computer simulation, I've been working on that, but I am not a computer person
anymore.
I can work on them, but I am very slow, and I'm not up on the newest software. The one simulation I did get done shut down the entire computer every time I started it because the computer didn't have the processing power to actually compute everything in the fluid flow.
Yeah.
We're trying to, like, flatter and cajole the people that we know that have, like, university multi-data processors, and actually my dad just got a job working for a company that I shall remain nameless, but that does that kind of thing for, like, animators and gene sequencers and stuff like that. That's the kind of processing power we need, because this thing is tweaking and pushing the limits of approximately 3 known laws of physics, all of which are hard to model. Right? You're talking about the drag and turbulence. You're talking about the heat and temperature differentials on a continuously changing range of temperature differentials throughout the system. It works by creating a miniature convection cycle, which is how weather works, which is one of the things that the triumph of the 20th century was being able to predict the weather within a few days to a week, right? But chaos theory comes into play on several aspects of these in ways that make it very hard to model accurately. Now, modeling it roughly, being able to put in the parameters and say, we've observed that these 6 systems, all each of them has this different flow speed. Now, can you tell us what something in between these two might come out at? Might be possible, might be very useful. And we've also got that animation that you had somebody do just to show roughly, like to visually show what's happening.
Ooh, I need to hear your feedback on how awesome the animation is.
But you just tell me how awesome it is, then I have to, like, give you some contrast to that already statement that you made. But, yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Accurate?
Pretty much. The only thing that was slightly inaccurate, and that actually relates to this question, is the way that the exhaust speeds up and spins inside the heat riser like a little mini tornado isn't necessarily something that's happening on all of the systems, but you can definitely make it happen by adding little fins inside the heat riser.
Well, the Coriolis effect comes into place, and it's like, well, do we have the fins go the other way?
No.
South of the equator?
This is one of the many ways that people apply the laws of physics in cavalier ways. Okay. Fins, cooling fins on a heat exchange barrel, I have not seen that. You've done it?
Done. Okay, so cooling fins on the bell.
On the bell.
I would love to see it done in a decorative way that made the bell look cooler and wasn't going to snag somebody's clothes as they walk by. But most people who think of cooling fins aren't in that kind of aesthetic design realm, so we need to find somebody who is an artful welder who's willing to do that in a really beautiful way.
Right. It works. It cools it down. It speeds it up. Speeds up your slow speed, but something to everybody keeps trying to make this thing more and more and more rockety. More and more and more rockety means that the system is working faster and faster and faster and faster.
It's a good way to burn more wood.
Yes.
This thing is designed to burn less wood and produce more heat.
Right. So the rule of thumb for burning up everything in the stream is time, temperature, and turbulence.
You need the material in the hot temperature that causes it to burn completely for a long enough time, and the turbulence gives you good enough mixing that you finish the complete chemical reaction, the conversion of the wood fuel into steam and carbon dioxide exhaust, rather than leaving unburned wood as smoke. And so to get that sweet spot, the type of heat riser length that fits inside a barrel that's raised up a certain height off the ground happens to give you a pretty complete enclosure of that flame path, and the turns in the J2 give you a pretty good turbulence that causes complete mixing and that complete burn. If you put blowers and fans on your exhaust and you're pulling it through faster, you will get absolutely reliable draft that won't smoke back in your house, but at the cost of possibly pulling the fire too fast.
And then you end up with smoke
outside your house, which is one of the reasons the EPA is really grumpy about wood-fired devices, is the outdoor smoke is getting to be a big issue as well.
All right.
So that it makes it less efficient for heating your house, even though it's more effective at drawing.
So I kind of think that there's two steps in getting more rocketiness that are good, as opposed to like somebody thinking about get more rockiness and then you end up with making your system less efficient. And I think the first one is find bottlenecks.
Yes.
And usually the first bottleneck is going to be where the heat riser meets the burn tunnel. That's going to be your number one bottleneck spot.
Especially if you do things like put a brick in sideways because you didn't have the tools to cut the brick, so you stuck a brick in the side, and now you've got a brick halfway obstructing your burn tunnel.
And collecting ash.
And collecting ash and everything else. I've seen a lot of different things people have done to obstruct this.
The other common one is downstream.
Yeah.
Where you'll either have the manifold that's too tight as it goes into the heat exchanger.
Yeah.
If you want to use high-tech materials there, getting a little thin refractory slab or kiln brick, so you have an insulative corner there that takes up a small amount of space and you can have a big manifold and a nice capacious junction. That's where you're going to be able to let the ash fall out in the manifold, make a big volume there. It's the only place in the system where you can put a big volume without hurting performance. And so if you make an ash settling pond before you go into your heat exchanger, you're going to stop the stove from having blockages in that area. You can go to a 2-year cleaning cycle and still be in good shape. And the other thing is, don't use corrugated ducting as an alternative to buying elbows.
So
it'll slow you down a lot too.
I kind of assume using corrugated ducting anywhere is a bad idea, and that shouldn't even be in version 0.7.
No, yeah,
I'm saying
aluminum, and all of it has too much drag.
So there's two things. One is to cure bottlenecks,
right?
Yeah.
And then there's two spots for the bottlenecks, is my thinking. And then I said the first one, and you said the second one.
The other place, there's one. There's a third bottleneck where if your heat riser goes up close to your barrel and is not tapered at the top, you can get ash buildup there, and it can eventually block off the system so you can't get enough smoke through that bottleneck to run properly. If you have ash buildup anywhere in your system, you will have the fire slow down and you will start having smoke back.
And then the second thing to get more rocketiness in a good way, whereas as opposed to now as of now, there's rockiness that's bad rocketiness, but to get more rockiness in a, is to have a taller heat riser.
Mm-hmm.
And so, which means usually if you're going to go for a taller heat riser, you're going to need a taller bell.
Right.
And then I've seen, and then just in the last few months, I've seen a lot more happening in the space of doing these things to get a taller heat riser. And it's like, I imagine you could have a heat riser that's just silly tall.
You can get
But I think for the most part, if you go for if you double barrel it, you're probably still in the space of okay.
You want to stop within, like, you want to give yourself at least 18 inches from the ceiling.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So you don't, like, burn your ceiling. So that makes a pretty good practical limit. If you are in the range between about 3.5 feet to, say, 6 feet tall on the heat riser, all the configurations I've seen in that range work pretty well. Things under 4 feet, depending on the length of your burn tunnel, can be iffy. So we say make it as tall as you can, but that's understanding that there are these limits as far as what you're using for a barrel and what you're using as far as ceiling clearance that are going to stop you before you get to excess.
Well, and then the reason why we've been kind of trying to keep everything as short as possible is that there are a lot of people out there who really have a problem with a 55-gallon drum in their living room. Okay, they don't do much to make them pretty. They stick them in there. People don't like them. They cover them with dirt or cob or plaster.
Which is a bad idea.
You can do a little bit, like you can cover one side up to
right.
A third of it with cob or tile or whatever, and it works really well. But the thing is, the barrel is an optimal shape for radiant heat. It's a circle that radiates out into the room really well. And the barrel cooling as it emits that radiant heat is what makes the system draft really well. And so if you cover too much of the barrel, or God forbid you insulate the barrel thinking that's going to help it, it makes it worse.
Yeah.
We've also had people looking at doing masonry bells, like with slab stone, and things like that can be really pretty. And Ernie's on ours right now. He's got a little blower fan that blows at the barrel to kind of move air around the house and cool the barrel down a little bit as it's drafting, and that works really well. I'm envisioning a little system where you'd hook up a blower fan behind the barrel, and you'd have like a little, like a punch tin metal lace doily, if you will, that kind of goes over the top third of the barrel or so and lets you run the blower fan through that and kind of spray warm air from that out into the room and start cooling the barrel in a really attractive way.
I see that the system you guys have, you looks like you've extended the barrel on yours by probably a foot or so.
We used a third of another 55-gallon drum to make the manifold and to extend the barrel
about 6 inches above
six
the...
6 inches? Yeah.
The burn tunnel.
Yeah.
There's enough room we could put another course of fire bricks on the burn tunnel if we wanted to.
Yeah. So I think we got a 40-inch heat riser in there.
And we've got a band on there that's designed to hold the lid on a drum. So it's one of these bolt-on bands so that we can unbolt and take the top barrel off if we want to and get in there for cleaning so that we don't need to add an extra clean out on it.
Yeah, this is one that if it works out really well, we're going to draft it up. And it, so far it's been working brilliantly. This is one that if it works out really well, we're going to draft it up and put it out as plans. And start discussing using the barrels this way, because it's very quick.
works really well, and all you need is a pair of tin snips.
You know, I just had a thought, and that was that if this whole thing where you guys are putting plans up on the internet and people are buying them for $30 a pop or something, if that works out really well, I would imagine you guys would probably put a lot more time into coming up with a lot more designs.
Oh, absolutely. It'll give us the money to come up with more designs. I, quite frankly, when I'm doing experimenting, if you think about how much firebricks cost and extra barrels and more stovepipe and all of that stuff, it ain't cheap. I mean, it literally, I get in trouble because I spend too much money on them.
Well, and sometimes,
and I'm a scrounger.
Somebody will call from Australia or Germany and they're putting one together and they want to know if they can do such and such with it, right? We've gone over the fact that there really isn't a computer model that we have access to that will effectively document this stuff. You need the kind of things you're using to figure out how jet engines and incinerators work. And so what Irene wants to do is build the system in the backyard and test it and see how it works and see what he needs to do to that system in the backyard to make it work, and then go back to the people that have, like, their little chateau in Germany and tell them it almost works and this is what you need to do. But in order to do that, Ernie's got to build the same thing, and he doesn't necessarily have the budget unless he's on the client's site using the materials they've already purchased to rough it out.
Or so somebody's willing to pay me for it.
The only plans that we put out, it actually, right now on them it says as-built drawings for information only, no warranty express or implied. But they are only documenting systems that we have built or helped other people build.
Multiple times.
Usually multiple times, and usually we put the plan out after the object that it's based on has been in operation for at least a year and is known to have worked for a full heating season.
So now, on that note,
we don't put out plans for something we think might work. We put out plans for something we know did work.
On that note, I've met a lot of people that claim to be an authority in making rocket mass heaters and or rocket stoves, and I've seen their work, and it falls short of the stuff that I've seen you guys do. And at the same time, when I've talked to those guys, they kind of say to me something to the tune of like, yeah, rocket mass heaters or rocket stoves, that's for tinkering in a garage or something like that. I mean, basically, I kind of get the feeling like they're resigned to, like, this is just a kind of a silliness, but they claim to be an expert in silly. And when I look at this stuff, my thinking is like, no, this is the way half the heating or more in the colder part of the United States should be, and I think that this is just the beginning for something that is amazing, spectacular, and the best, far superior than a conventional wood stove. And you guys go out there and you build it and prove it to be true because you give a damn and you know what the hell you're doing, whereas these other guys who claim to be experts in the field, I think that they just don't get it. I think that they're like, and they're resigned to being tinkerers. And in fact, tinkering is kind of how they describe what they're doing, and they just don't have the passion behind it or the drive. And I think frankly, they just don't quite fully comprehend it.
When solar cookers went to the refugee camps in northern Africa, they got a reputation. That was one of the few places they were taken that they took. They you know, people wanted them and used them. They got a reputation as rape stoppers. Because women going out to collect firewood were vulnerable to assault. And
right.
If you didn't need to do that, it saved lives.
Okay.
So we're coming from this on the assumption that in the next 100 years, people who can't grow enough wood near enough their house or can't find enough fuel to stay warm, we're going to go back to the situation we had a couple 100 years ago where people die every winter because they're too cold. So we're looking for something that's going to work in a long-term kind of way, because we see that this need right now, and especially in the American market right now, it's kind of a fun hobby option. It's a thing to think about, but, you know, you can go back to the forced air heating if you want to at any point. That may not be the case. You know, we're already running into, my dad's an engineer, and he was really not happy about paying for heating oil. You know, he's a
pretty well-paid professional, and that still is a chunk out of their budget that, you know, paying $1,000 more than once a winter to refill your heating oil tank is getting a little steep, and it's going to keep getting steeper. So, yeah, we're passionate about this being something that if we can make it work for a large number of people, could have a big impact on the ease of the future weaning from petroleum. And we've also worked with 3 or 4 master masons. I mean, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. Yeah. Actually, about half a dozen, because we had a couple of people that were just, you know, just the everyday handyman kind of mason, just a bricklayer that's what he worked at all his life, and he's now kind of retired and enjoying traveling. He doesn't think of himself as a smart guy, because he's been taught all his life that people who work with their hands are not as smart as people that read things in a book and write things, you know, with a license. But the brilliance of understanding of physical reality that comes from that kind of life's work experience is something we really respect. And we're at the beginning, and I'm at the beginning of my learning curve. I guess Ernie's kind of nearing the middle of his as far as knowing this, but we still run things by Ernie's dad. We run things by Fleming Abramson in Denmark. We run things by some architect friends that we have. We run things by, we make a point to showcase anytime we get an experienced master mason in a workshop and let him show people how he levels a brick pad so we can watch him do it and see if he's got any tricks that the last guy we worked with didn't have. Watching Andy from Ireland whack a brick off with a trowel, one stroke, exactly the angled cut he wants every time. I mean, that level of skill is something that used to be you could hire somebody like that in any town. You know, even digging a ditch. Have you ever tried to dig a ditch that was exactly a 1% slope so it got the water where it needed to go?
With not square sides and a flat bottom?
You know, like people talk about that guy's so stupid he's going to have to try to make a living as a ditch digger. Most of the so-called smart people who are out there reading books and telling you they know how to do it couldn't dig a ditch to save their ass.
Right. So when we're talking about saving the world, I mean, you're talking about something where it's like there could be there's probably millions of people out there that could die without this bit of knowledge. Like this
right.
bit of knowledge could save their life. So now my perspective in a lot of this is that I think that this could end many of the wars that we're getting involved in. I mean, if half the homes in the United States were heated with this way, the amount of energy that would be reduced that we would use would be so dramatically reduced that it kind of takes the fuel out, if you will, from a lot of our wars. Our wars are based on oil. And on top of that, not only save people a lot of money and things like that, but it's like when we start talking about renewable stuff, there's only one form of heat that I can think of that is more sustainable than this. This is the cleanest and most sustainable form of heat with the exception of one thing, and that would be using annualized thermal inertia like what you find in a Wolf Adi. Because basically...
I would say direct solar of any kind. If you can do a passive solar house that requires no fuel, that's your absolute best option. And if you need to supplement your solar gain at certain times of year, this is an efficient way to do that.
I think an annualized thermal inertia system like an Wolf Adi is going to be better than any kind of passive solar system or even non-passive solar system.
I'm saying your Wolf Adi is a brilliant culmination of the passive solar thing. What you're doing is you're taking that passive solar and making it work for a full year cycle, not just for an overnight cycle.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah,
you're using solar only.
So that way if you have 2 weeks of clouds, you're still warm as toast.
Right, because you've
enough used
thermal inertia to go past that or even go past the whole winter part of that cycle.
And you've used zero energy.
Yeah, and I've got a 3-ton thermal that I can beef up and use to supplement.
Right. So if you've got a conventional home, you can't use a Wolf Adi. You can't do a Wolf Adi.
Passive solar is scotched because your neighbor is growing his timber crop right on your property line, and you've got a small property and you can't move back far enough to get enough sunlight into your house. There's situations where people are building houses that just aren't that practical
there are a limited number of situations where you just can't get enough solar gain in that location.
So then, you know, my thinking is that when it comes to being the most sustainable, then it's kind of like, you know, if you look at any other form of heat that people use now, whether it's wood, whether it's going to be oil, whether it's going to be natural gas or electricity or whatever, for each one of those are not as sustainable as a rocket mass heater. And I mean, and then as we start talking about how we can optimize this even further, I mean, we do have at least one case that I'm aware of, maybe there's more, where a guy heated his home one winter using nothing but junk mail. Yeah. And then we got, you know, several cases, including you guys, where you heated your home winter after winter using nothing but the twigs and branches that just naturally fell off the trees in your yard.
Right.
And so it's kind of like, I mean, this is incredibly sustainable. And so, but anyway, you're saying something about saving lives. That, you know what, I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. This is something that, with a little bit of knowledge, could be saving lives in a big, big way across the world.
Well, and even at a personal level, this gets into kind of woo a little bit.
Yeah.
But working with Earth, working with Earth and materials, a lot of people find it very therapeutic. It's very grounding. And working with fire and burning things is also something I think a lot of people are attracted for, because it has that therapeutic value. It's something human beings have been doing for a long time, and it's used in different cultures as part of grief healing ceremonies, or a lot of churches have candles or fire, or sacred fire of some kind. Even just on the personal level, if you want to live in kind of more of a peacemaker kind of way rather than an exploitive or violent kind of way, this can be a way to take some of that energy that often gets channeled into conflict. Building with earth, chopping firewood, and burning things can be a very productive way to take that energy and get yourself back into a space where you're in harmony with your surroundings. So.
Well, here's my thing about it when we're talking about saving lives and developing this stuff. I spent most of my life as an adult inside the Arctic Circle. Right? Winter does not bother me a bit. I've also spent quite a lot of time at the other end of the world in places that are doggone cold and in the south. Okay, way south. All right, you've got to, if you look at a globe.
Antarctica?
Yeah, around that area.
Okay. Well, you spent time in Southeast Asia and Africa,
right,
and the Gulf as well. I mean, you've been in hot places too.
Right, but if you look at the band that's hot on the planet Earth that doesn't need any heating, it's pretty doggone small. Right? It really is.
It's sea level within a certain distance of the equator.
Right. There's a lot of stuff that's in the cold area, and most of these cook stoves were all designed for hot area use. You can cook on a rocket stove, on a rocket mass heater. You've got a 40-inch top to deal with, or a 25-inch top to deal with. I can put my pressure cooker up there and pressure can on top of it. Winter food for a lot of people is stews and chowders and things like that. Your rocket mass heater will do that.
So about the only thing that we're doing for all the people that are going to get flooded out of Bangladesh,
yeah,
is lowering the concentration of carbon dioxide that's going into the atmosphere by using current biofuel energy efficiently,
right,
rather than using fossil fuels or putting out a lot of larger molecule smoke and gas that's a more efficient greenhouse gas.
Right.
But we're doing a small amount for them by doing a lot for the people that have the money to otherwise be burning all that fossil fuel.
Right. You know, and people that live in temperate regions a friend of mine was working on stoves for Morocco. The rocket mass heater makes sense in Morocco. It gets cold in Morocco.
They have mountains.
They have mountains.
Two sets of Atlas mountains.
When you get into southern Africa, I mean, way down there, it gets cold.
They got mountains all over Africa.
Right. And even where they don't have mountains, there's places where it gets cold. And a rocket mass heater
is designed to warm things up with a little bit of wood. It's not designed to allow you to have a cooking fire in your home like the rocket cookers are. And almost all those cultures that have the need to go get firewood like that, that aren't first world, unquote and unquote, first world countries, it means the women are out collecting wood. The women are vulnerable. The children are out collecting wood. The children are vulnerable. Those places are active with people who don't like the situation they're in. You're talking high rape, death, walking through landmines, all kinds of things. And they're also subject to deforestation. So you give them a rocket mass heater and all of a sudden they stop deforesting everything because all they need is a few twigs.
At this point, based on the BTU calculations, if the entire world went to wood heat or wood fuel to replace fossil fuels one for one, we would run out of wood worldwide in about a year.
Yes.
So the other thing that the rocket mass heater does, I think somebody started to ask this question, is like a comparison of how it works compared to a wood stove or other kinds of heat. If you can make a smaller number of BTUs keep you comfortable and you don't need as much to stay comfortable, if we can actually get our usage, not just of fossil fuels, but our usage of any kind of supplemental power fuel, if we can get that usage back down to where it's within the growth limits of current solar biofuels, then we're looking at we might actually make it. If we're stuck on only rich people can afford biofuels and we're taking feedstocks that could otherwise be used for building someone's house and we're turning that into the biochar or fuel for somebody that can afford it, and somebody else gets, you know, dropped off the back end of the planet. That's how it works. So anyway,
yeah. All right.
It's not that it's just got to be fun and rockety. It's got to work for it to be worth putting this much time into. So, but yeah, next question. Somebody else was saying, if you wanted, could you detail how to build it outside, test it? Somebody else agrees with this. Rory agrees with this, and it ties into my question. Namely, how do you get it past the inspectors or insurers? I've seen Ernie and Erica's draft building code they were kind enough to post on their website. I'm wondering if they can provide some real-world examples they've dealt with. I'd also like to hear about any upcoming rocket stove seminars they're aware of.
We covered the seminars
earlier, and we will be posting the dates of those on our website and on Permies.
And our rocket stove in Portland was the perfect example of how to deal with code.
We used it as a test case. We went and we looked into what kind of permits we needed. We needed a mechanical permit. So it was a rental situation. So our landlady graciously went in as an owner builder and asked for the permit, the mechanical permit. And she was told by the lady in the code office, what is it? And she said, well, it's a rocket mass heater, and she had the book with her. And the lady said, does it burn wood? And the landlady said, yes. And she said, then it's a wood stove. You need this permit. It's a wood stove mechanical permit. She brings it home. She's like, I got the permit. We look at it. We're like, where do we send the drawings? And it says they don't need drawings. They just say install it and have us inspect it within 180 days. So, well, that seems easy. So we built it. And we called them, you know, 180 days is 6 months. So I think we called them 4 or 5 months later just to make sure, you know, we had a little bit more we wanted to do with it. But
winter was over.
So the inspector comes in, and we did thoroughly test it before we called the inspectors. Inspector comes over. He's like, I heard you had a wood stove you want me to look at. He's standing in the living room, and we say, well, you're looking at it. It is right there. And he kind of looks up and down and says, what's that? You know? And we say, well, it's a rocket mass heater. Here's the book. Here's the plans. Here's our website where we put the step-by-step building process up. And he's like, wow, you guys really aren't trying to hide anything, are you? And the landlady even paid $600 for up to code through the roof, chimney, double wall, all this stuff that you would need for a conventional wood stove. And Ernie almost peeled the sticker off. I was like, stop! We need that sticker, because what the inspectors are trained to do is look for the UL lab sticker on the equipment, making sure you bought new stuff that's been lab tested. It's not somebody's recycled stovepipe that's got creosote in it already or whatever, or extra holes, you know. And so he looks at it. He's like, we show him how it works. We light it up. We go outside. We look at the no smoke. We come back in to show that it's still, in fact, burning. We go outside and look at the no smoke again, and we come in and make sure that the fire hasn't gone out, and that's why there's no smoke. We do this 3 or 4 times with any given inspector. He gets really interested in how do we stop small children from falling into it, and we're not sure that this is a problem because at the height they can fall into it, it's all cob, and it's not hot. But it turns out what he wants to do is tell us about his cool, like, wrought iron thing that he made for his kids to hang their mittens on. It's like a little fence around his wood stove.
Oh, wow.
So, like, he's solved this problem already, and he's really excited about it because he knows that we're into making stuff, and he's into this thing that he made, and it's really... So, you know, he's a cool guy. He got signed up for this job because he likes looking at things, right?
Okay.
But he can't sign off on our rocket mass heater because, A, it's supposed to have a wood stove UL sticker for this wood stove permit. This turns out this was for wood stoves as such, and a rocket mass heater is not a wood stove. It's exempt by weight.
Even though the city of Portland told you.
Well, a person. You got to understand, any given bureaucracy, it's a person who's like, my job is to give the person the permit they need. So wood stove, right?
Oh, yeah. So they cut corners.
No, there was...
cut corners, and so then they issued false information, and you were foolish enough to believe it.
Well, and technically our landlady believed what she was told, and she didn't necessarily know as much about these things as we do. And we didn't go in with her, and we could have, you know. On the other hand, now we have one that they issued us a permit for, so we got to kind of work together and see if we can get out of this hole that we both got ourselves into together.
Okay.
Which is keeping our house warm as we work it out. So that was kind of nice. It was a good situation to be in, as it turned out. The permit that we should have probably gotten would have been a mechanical permit as such that would have cost 10 times as much, and you submit drawings, and their engineer looks at them first, and then you build it. And the main thing they're looking for with that is if you're putting over 900 kilos of mass in your house, you're putting, in our case, about 3 tons of masonry in your house, they want to make sure you've got a foundation underneath that that's going to support it. And especially if you're building what they had it set up for is masonry heaters, which is a vertical chimney of masonry. And so that's a heavy thing with a lot of inertial moment. Like, its top is very tall, and it could fall on someone if the foundation's not adequate. And it could fall on someone while it's on fire. And you can see how this worries someone who's used to owner-builders wanting to do odd things that might not make sense if you had been around the block a few times.
Right.
So then we go through this process where the inspector brings his boss, and his boss brings the EPA guy for 5 counties, and they come over all together again, and they want to look at it again, and we light it, and they go outside to see the no smoke, and they come back in and make sure the fire's still going, and we didn't, like, stop the fire to stop the smoke, and we come back outside, and they make sure there's no other chimney.
Are you sure this chimney is actually connected to that fire?
Exactly, exactly. Can we, like blow something colored through it and prove it to you? And they look at it, and the guy's like, well... You know, the supervisor's like, I can't inspect it because I don't know what to inspect it for. You're going to have to put it through the side of our department that handles the engineered stuff, and it's going to be kind of spendy. And it's just like, when we talked to him on the phone, he was like, you have a what? Is it a fireplace or a wood stove? It's a rocket mass heater. It's a type of masonry stove, if you want to get technical. Is it a fireplace or a wood stove? Okay.
No,
that's the answer. In 1993, there was a hearing in Portland about this, going over the fact that a masonry heater is not necessarily a fireplace or a wood stove, although there are masonry heaters that might also qualify as a fireplace. Right? Like, but here, look at this document that your department has gone through this 10 years ago. It's like that, only more different. Oh, okay. But it turns out Portland has this thing called the Alternative Technologies Advisory Committee, which is designed to make it less stupid to try to get a sustainable, environmentally beneficial technology through this building code process. And they don't rubber stamp everything. What they do is they work with you in a question and answer kind of process. They got a couple architects, they got a natural builder, they got a couple engineers on this committee. Most of them, I think, are citizen volunteers. But they'll just work with you to tweak this thing until it's ready to be submitted to the legal appeals process for it to become an accepted alternative, right? At that point, it's been tweaked by this committee, and a couple of them are on the other committee. So somebody in the department knows what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they've had a chance to tell you, that part won't work for us. That part, you might need to reword that, right? And so you can get, it's one of the only cities I know of that has such a thing, and you can work the building code out over time with people who kind of know what it's going to take to get something, like they've already got Cobb fireplaces through. It's something that you can build in Portland. They were working on gray water systems through this process. So there's all these things that other cities might not even be willing to take the time to do that Portland was willing to work with us on. So that's what we're on. We've got the code document pretty well roughed out to the point where the guy that we're working with from the committee has created a new formatted document that we can't edit anymore to, like, nail that down. So that's looking kind of final. And then we've got some drawings that need to go in with that. And then that's going out. So, but in the process, this is what I was wanting to describe this story again for. They kept asking us these funny questions, the inspectors at our house. Like, is this your only way to heat the house? Well, we want to show that we're goody-two-shoes, right? And we're like, no, there's a furnace in the other building that feeds into this house, and we can keep the walls up to 68 degrees at 3 feet from the floor in the farthest corner of the house with that furnace, but we don't use it when we got the Rocket Mass heater because it works so much better.
The moral of the story is that if you were to say yes...
If you were to say yes, it's my only way to heat the house, then you get an exemption from the EPA burn bans and so on that they don't have to go... Trying to find out who it is in the EPA that writes a letter that says this is exempt from EPA because it's heavier than a wood stove, there's an exemption by weight. If it's over 900 kilos, it's a site-built masonry heater. They don't make you ship a masonry heater to the lab and get it tested and then ship it back to install it in the house because everyone is site-built. Everyone is different. They will not meet the guidelines for testing a wood stove, right? It's a different animal. And so there's an exemption for things over a certain weight because the only people who do that are people who know how to do a clean fire. That's the point of these masonry heaters, short, clean fire. EPA is not too worried about them and recognizes it would be a hassle to try to ship that much masonry, and the tests might not be that useful anyway because it sort of often cracks when you ship it.
Right.
So, and it would be kind of counterproductive to spend that much fossil fuel to ship it. So there's an exemption for if it's the only way to heat your house, if it is your only way to cook, or if it's an antique, you can get an exemption for wood stove. And those are things that your local inspector is allowed to sign off on. Well, it looked a little funny, but it's their only way to heat, and I think it seems like a pretty reasonable thing to let these poor folks have a way to heat their house, right?
Right. You didn't know that.
If it's the only way to cook, is it your only way to cook? Well, no, we've got a kitchen. We're normal. We have an electric range, right? Well... Now they can't give us that exemption. And so the EPA inspector stays an extra hour after the building inspectors have gone home, and he's looking at it. He's like, well, it's an old design, right? It's like this European-style, old-fashioned design. Could you call it an antique? And we're like, we built it. We posted the pictures on the Internet, the rocket stove itself. Like, the rocket mass heaters are only about 20 years old as a design. I don't think it would qualify as an antique that way. And he looks, and he goes in and out, and we talk about
like,
horrible...
I'm trying to help you here.
He's like, well, dirt's old. God bless them. You know, they want to be able to say yes. So those are four ways that your inspector can say yes without you needing to submit engineered plans, which is it your only way to heat? Is it your only way to cook? Is it an antique? If you incorporate a component of an antique wood stove in there and you get a friendly inspector, they might be able to say yes.
Okay.
You know,
all right.
If you install it before you put your secondary heater in, and it is currently your only way to heat, you might be able to get it to pass the inspection, even though it wouldn't necessarily qualify if they came back later.
Okay.
And you've got something else put in. So it's like, or if you're doing it in a passive solar home where there is no other on-demand heat, then you'd be permanently qualified under that exemption. So there are ways to get exemptions, and then there's the official process, which is you submit a set of drawings, which is one of the reasons why we think people might be willing to pay money for our drawings of stoves that work somewhere else, because then you have drawings that look like they were done by a professional.
Professionally, yeah.
Right? You know, I'm not an architect, but I did have enough drafting classes to be able to put something out that looks like I might know what I'm talking about.
Right.
You know, I don't have an engineer license. I can stamp it for you. You don't have anybody else whose ass is on the line for you if it doesn't work. But you've got something that's going to look very reasonable to a building inspector if you want to go that route and have it absolutely legal. then you've got to submit drawings. You might need to get a sympathetic engineer to look them over and do work with you on that prototype in your backyard and say, yeah, I'm willing to put my license on the line to say this will work. And if you submit an engineer-stamped drawing to your local building committee and say, I want to put in a masonry heater of this type, as in, can I get the permit, the mechanical permit, to say, yes, you've got the floor support and you've got a design that we approved. And you can put one in legally that way, but right now it's not in the code. It's going to have to go through their alternative approvals process.
So now I know that
you're not getting it by the insurance companies.
No, if it goes through their, if the engineer drawing goes through the process.
Exactly. If it goes through code,
it's approved.
It's approved, and the insurers will have it. But if it has not gone through code, you are not getting it past the insurance companies.
Yeah, so if you're going by an exemption,
they want someone to hang.
If they're going, you're going to use the exemptions, then you're probably not going to have an insurance company be real happy about that. If you go through the submit the drawings and have the engineer stamp it and get the official permit, then you probably that permit is what the insurance companies look at. Is was it approved by the local building officials? Yes. Okay, it must be safe. Right.
Which kind of comes back to the whole thing of like, and if you're going to get a mortgage, then you have to insure your home.
Yeah.
And so then basically it's like, okay, so, you know, for a lot of places, it's like, anyway, that whole area gets very, very complicated. And it's like I stopped by a place on the way here where the guy is living in an area that has all these requirements and stuff like that, but then he elected to buy bare land, build his home, totally against, he did not get a permit, even though for what he was building, he probably needed a permit. And then he was asking me questions about building a rocket mass heater, and, of course, he has no concerns whatsoever about insurance,
exactly.
No concerns about permitting. He's going to build anything that he wants, and he knows how to build stuff and all that stuff. And so the key is, in fact, the wood stove he was using at the moment that I was there was a wood stove that he built himself. He welded it himself. And and he has a fair bit of knowledge in this space, but the thing is that he was telling me, like, if he went and he got all the permits and stuff like that, he would have probably dropped something in the order of, you know, beyond more than 10 grand in order to get all of the paperwork and stuff like that. And then he would have had a bunch of people who didn't know what the hell they were talking about telling him what to do because he knows more than they do. And so basically he is opting for, he is choosing a life of flagrantly saying, a life of crime, effectively, yeah, black market housing for his family, and he has children, and it's like, you know what, I don't want to hear from those people anymore, they're idiots, and it's like, so he's starting from scratch, his own piece of land, building his own home, and even though it's in an area that's got all these regulations and stuff like that, he's like, he's just not dealing with it, and he once told me a story about how he did something kind of similar in another place, and nobody ever gave him any grief. But then again, he's kind of a guy that it's like if somebody comes and gives him grief, he'll give them 10 pounds more grief than they gave him. And in the meantime, his neighbor was a guy who was a perfectly lovely, charming man who tried to do like tried to fix his roof. He had a hole in his roof, and he tried to fix the roof. And the city came down on him like a load of bricks and ended up fining him $20,000 for attempting to fix his roof without a permit.
Yep.
And but they did not talk to the other guy, the guy I was talking to a couple of days ago, about all the changes that he was doing without permits, because the city knew who it was and the city did not want to tangle with this guy because it would have just been a big headache. But then the lovely, pleasant man, they went after him for 20 grand. And it's kind of like, so let's see if I understand this correctly. Our society is trying to make people mean and nasty and hostile, and so crazy pays,
no.
Hostile pays, being, you know,
no,
really
what they're trying to
having
make
a reputation pays.
Yeah.
Right? Like your reputation can can be based on you built the inspector's house and you know what kind of brownies he likes.
Right.
It doesn't have to be nasty. You can also know that the guy likes his coffee black and he likes chocolate chip cookies, and if you just happen to have some of those when he comes by and he sits on your rocket stove for half an hour and talks before he asks you what the thing is, he might be in a good mood that day, you know?
Right.
You don't... the Portland inspectors wouldn't touch a drop of anything. I think they probably had a policy about not taking anything that might be seen as a bribe, because,
that path's a pretty well-worn path.
Yeah, but if
have some cinnamon rolls fresh out of the oven.
Right. So if you're... If you have a reputation locally that's going to back you up, then that's going to help your case, too. If you just moved into an area and you want to do a crazy thing without learning the lay of the land as far as the local policy, government's made of people, right?
Right.
And so the way that you're dealing with government is politics, and that's where, you know, Ernie's family tends to be more on the I know what I'm doing and everybody knows it, and so... don't mess with me. And my family tends to be more on the, these people have a job to do and they're trying to do the right thing. Let's just make sure that it's very clear that what we're doing is the right thing.
Right.
So
we work the politics, they work the physical reputation for knowing what they're doing, and either one of those can make it easier for you to get your job done.
So I'm thinking that I'm hearing of a lot of people that are building rocket mass heaters, and they are not exploring how legal are they. How legal is it? How okay is it for, is the government okay? Is the insurance with it okay or whatever? And they're building them anyway. And frankly, I think that if we get to the point that we have half of the homes in the United States, in the colder part of the United States, with a rocket mass heater, and none of them really went and got any permitting or anything like that, and they came into existence, then eventually that's the point when the government and the insurance companies and whatnot will start to say, all right, we know that this is such a common thing that
it
we're going to now, it becomes the norm,
state of
and
the
then make it, as opposed to if you try to play it the right game. I mean, because how long has that process been going on that you've been trying to get the Portland stuff lined up the right way?
At this point, it's probably been 2 or 3 years, and at least a year of that has been just us and the other guy that we're working with from the committee having life happen in the meantime. You know, we had this situation where we moved up here to be with Ernie's parents, you know, they had a medical situation, and we had a thing where we wanted more space than we could get in Portland. And so we spent the last 6 months moving and building the thing we're moving into.
Years. And it still isn't done.
And they need to be very careful because, like you were saying, I think it was off the air about insurance companies, the building code people have the insurance companies riding on everything they say. And so just like the medical industry, you get into serious hardcore, what they call CYA.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Every piece of paperwork has to be countersigned by the right person, so it's not you on the line if something goes wrong. Because if something goes wrong, there's a lot of money involved in
absolutely.
People have
my point,
lawyers.
My point is that here's a city that's open to the idea of having innovation in the space of eco stuff, and they've got a program for that, and years have passed. It still isn't done. It could go on for years more, and then you go to some city where you're going to try and do something like this, and they don't have a program like that, or they're not so understanding, and it seems to me like they'll just say no because they just don't want to fool with it. We don't have the budget to be able to even consider your craziness. Do not innovate. It is illegal to innovate. Stop it now.
Which is where you got to know, first off, a passive solar building, not going to run into that. You can put windows wherever you want in a building, and they're not going to give you a hassle.
As long as they're properly headered and supported.
The EPA exemptions that allow them to sign off without their ass being on the line is excellent. And an engineer or architect who is a licensed professional, them signing your plans means their license is on the line for it, so the inspector knows that it's not his ass on the line. It's that licensed professional. So as you basically, you need something that allows them to know that when they say yes, it's not their ass on the line.
So now
that's the way you play the inspection game.
I've heard once you bring in an engineer, it's minimum $5,000. Is that true?
It depends on the engineer. Usually, yes. You know, that's... It's $5,000 is certainly what you pay for the UL lab testing of a device. And I know a lot of independent licensed professionals who do this kind of work where they can't take a job for less than some number of grand just to keep their business running, because there's expenses involved in maintaining your licensure and there's liabilities involved. And so any job that you do has to be worth it, because each time you sign that paper, you are literally, you're putting your ass on the line is how you make your living, right? And any one project that you don't give enough attention to and it goes wrong could be your license, and then you got to have enough saved up to live to retirement on based on what you did before that, right? Mm-hmm. So they got to make their money. That said, there's a lot of engineers out there who think this kind of stuff is really pretty cool, right? And so the possibility of becoming the local engineer who does rocket mass heaters, you got a fair chance of finding that guy who thinks that would be really cool. And, you know, he's been an engineer for a while, and he's also got some other skill to fall back on, and he's not that scared of losing his license over doing the right thing. And so we have found engineers who are willing to work within their client's budget on something like this. But it's people. It's finding the local person or a person from somewhere else, you know, a Danish architect who's willing to sign off on your project or whatever, because they know the masonry heaters in a way that your local officials might not.
All right, so as a quick summary here, what we've got is that, you could build a rocket mass heater in a weekend, and if you scrounge the parts for maybe $20, but you might need to shell out $5,000 for an engineer, and it could take 2 years to maybe 7 years to get everything okie-dokied, and, you know, your insurance. So basically, it's like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours, maybe even thousands of hours worth of legwork that has everything to do with paperwork, government, politics, pencil pushers, and, you know, just all kinds of people who don't know, don't care, and will say anything just to get you to go away.
Your job, if you're going to go the code route for this, your biggest job is education. That's what you are going to be doing. Literally, you're going to be educating the inspectors. You're going to be educating the architect. You're going to be educating the engineer. Everybody you talk to, you're going to wind up educating them.
I will say that we are educators, and our consulting fees start in the few hundred dollars, and it might be well worth the investment. Spend $30 on a set of plans, or $300 on having us do a site visit and write up a general plan of action,
right,
that's going to let you tell them to call us when they want a better explanation than you might be ready to give of how this works and why it's safe.
And while it sounds like a racket, you know, we're charging money for this stuff, and there's some people who say, oh, no, I won't charge any money. Most people...
We're in this space where it's a functional improvement on a $30,000 masonry heater.
Yeah.
Because it gives you more instant radiant heat and better, more efficient burn and better fuel efficiency. And we are competing against the do-it-yourselfer advocates who say, I've built one for $50. So somewhere in that $50,000 to $30,000 range is the fair price for what we do. Possibly it should be more than $30,000 because it improves on the function of some of those masonry heaters.
Yeah, and the do-it-yourself guys are what we talked about at very first.
But frankly, we like the do-it-yourself guys.
Yeah.
So we try to make ourselves accessible to people who want to do that.
Can we get on with the questions? So this is from Carl Gunlegenson. I'm sorry, I probably just slaughtered your name.
For heater starting, is a preheating or priming burn chamber a good idea? And where would it be located in the system? I don't want to use a propane torch for starting. I live in a cold climate, and in extreme weather, there can be strong chimney downdrafts that make a conventional wood stove difficult to start. What can I do with my rocket mass heater design to minimize this effect? That's a really good question.
Make a brick heat riser, and thank you very much for that question.
That's a really, that's this guy's paying attention to how stuff burns and how the wind works and things like that. This is a guy that I would love to work with.
Okay, Carl, yours is a situation where you do not use a metal heat riser at all.
Yep, you want the heat riser to retain some heat so it's warm from the day or two before that you burned it, and then that heat is going to keep your draft going positive. With a wood stove, this is something that happens a lot, and most people don't know this, especially if you put a wood stove in your basement for emergency heat, is you've just created a cold path that goes down into your house, and if your chimney is cold above the roof, or if it doesn't go above your ridgeline, your house is naturally going to want to draft up through the attic vents and pull cold down your wood stove to balance the airflow through your house. A house, to be safe, should be recycling its air, what is it, like 3 times an hour?
Yeah.
Or every 3 hours?
Something like that.
Look it up for your area because it's different in different areas, but for adequate ventilation so you don't asphyxiate and you don't have mold problems in your house is always cycling fresh air through itself, and your cold wood stove chimney will become part of the intake of that system. And so what you need to do is prime or preheat that chimney so it becomes hotter and better drafty than the rest of your house. For our rocket mass heaters, since we live in our home, we work from our home, and so we're running them at least every other day usually in the winter, or we have our father-in-law walk up the hill and run it a couple of times a week if we're out of town. We don't tend to need to prime it, because it retains enough heat to be self-priming on that kind of at least a couple times a week burn cycle. If you're gone a lot, like if you are a snowbird and you leave for January, but then you've got to come back and go back to work in February, and you're going to have to start a cold stove in winter. Some things we've used are a very small fan in the chimney. That's one time, and it might be a good idea to have a fan with a switch in the chimney that you can turn on temporarily to get the draft going the right way. We don't do that. We put a candle under the heat riser and just leave the candle in there until we can see when we pull it out that the flame's going the right direction. Just like with a fireplace, you might light a wad of newspaper. Make sure your damper's open and the fireplace is drafting before you light your fire. So some of those techniques that you know from wood stoves or fireplaces, you can use to get a rocket mass heater drafting as well.
Yeah,
or you can put a fan with a switch on and just use it for that once in a while cold start.
I like the candle thing. Because you just light the candle, shove it down there, wait 15 minutes or 20 minutes. You know,
and you can easily check if it's been enough time because the flame.
You can check, pull the candle out, start your fire, bada bing, you're done. If you put a priming hole in there, it's another place for a leak, another place for a smoke leak, another place to fight things. We dealt with the, We dealt with the I don't suffer fools gladly. I really kind of get irritated by it, so read the forum, please.
So I'm thinking let's stop at that question.
That's all right.
So and mostly because my I got to get going and on to the next thing, and but I also feel like that was a very long podcast. I mean,
yes.
Is it getting to be lunchtime yet?
Yes.
We started with breakfast.
It's 1:55.
Oh man, this is a 4-hour podcast or something. Okay. all right. Do you guys have anything else you just have to say in this podcast?
I will just say the.
Really? You're gonna
ask nice questions that actually go somewhere. Look at the forum before you start asking a bunch of questions, because we've written it down.
Well, we're getting to the point where it's getting popular enough,
right?
That we're getting a lot more new people that are just itching to learn this stuff. But
right.
Then they show up and they'll have not listened to this podcast,
right?
They'll have very low information, and we need to. And I think the thing that the pod people could really help with is to help kind of field some of the beginner questions that you know,
right.
So that way it leaves the tougher stuff for you and Erica.
And at the same time, tell these guys. You know, if it's not a rocket stove, if it's not a rocket mass heater, like one of the ones I just saw, they're basically making a tin can rocket stove out of bricks. So it's basically going to be a cooking rocket with this special little draft thing going out. Anyway, it's a train wreck.
You're right.
And someone's going to get on me about their rocket stove not working. And it's not a rocket stove.
Yeah.
It's not R&M.
Building something that doesn't follow either the guidelines in the book or any of the plans out there that we've discussed under the name of Rocket Mass Heater, we feel like kind of a magic eight ball where people will, like, put something together on a CAD program or in a pencil sketch and then be like, I want to build this thing where I've replaced six of the parts with something else and it goes in different directions and I'm going to call it a Rocket Mass Heater and is that going to make it work? Magic eight ball. And the answer is, it depends, or the future is cloudy. You know, it's just like...
What is it Ernie always says? Build it, something like
build it outside and let's see. We've got a lot of really good questions on here, but most of them have been addressed in either earlier part of this podcast or on the forums. There are two that I'd like to talk to.
Well, we can do another podcast, too.
Yes, we'd love to come to Australia if you can find a way to pay for the travel. Otherwise, you got to wait for us to finish the boat. And, yes, if you have a bigger hole in your house already, putting the right size diameter pipe through that bigger hole and insulating around it is the way to go, Lori. That brings us to the very last question.
All right.
We would love to go to Australia and teach rocket stoves. We really would. Same with every other country, okay? Fine. We don't want you guys to have to travel to us when it's cheaper for us to travel to you.
But that means you got to get together with the other people on your continent or in your region and put together a workshop or set of workshops
right. That's
going to make that worth doing both ecologically and financially.
And I think it's fair to say, like when Seth comes over here,
exactly.
Then it's like somebody said, here is a bale of money, Sep.
Right.
And so Sep's like, okay, I'm covered. And then the person who put up the bale of money said, and now I'm going to try and sell tickets and to get my bale back. And so, somebody believed enough in the value of Sep's work to say, I'm going to do this, and it will clean me out, but I'm willing to take the risk because I think it's so important.
Yeah, one of the things is don't fly that, what is it, third or fourth rule of permaculture, okay, where
the third ethic,
okay. Let's see, for the last several years, we've lived on less than $10,000 a year, okay, because we've been pouring it into other things like this research, and nobody wants to pay for it. Okay, it's not a surplus. It's not a surplus, guys. So we do have to charge something for it. We're happy to do the permies, you know, the wood stove thing at the permies. We're giving a lot away, but you got to work for it a little bit there.
Yeah, a little help, a little mini hands make light work.
Exactly.
It takes a long time to save up for EPA testing on that kind of budget. So.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 All right.
If you think we ought to do it, so you don't have to, maybe we can turn that around.
So, anything else to add to this podcast?
Thank you.
I have to pee.
Yeah, and thank you, Paul, because I know you do this with a lot of people, not just us, putting out the good ideas and putting out the word of mouth that does things like fill that Sep Holzer workshop and bring people over here we wouldn't otherwise get to meet.
I'm trying. I'm making the world a better place.
Yeah,
it's just, you know, a lot of legwork.
You know, have fun trying your rocket stove. Right? Build it outside. Build it in your backyard. Don't do something stupid that's going to make me tell you, well, test it in your backyard and tell us how it works.
You've already tested it in your backyard, then you're not being stupid, and we can talk.
You know, severe burns, if that's not enough motivation, there is the extra motivation that Ernie could be mad at you.
And come to workshops. When we're putting on, like, a fire science theater or something like that, we don't really charge that much. Most of the people who have us there really don't charge that much for the workshop. In fact,
they're mostly, we have to keep having them do things like actually pay for the amount of money they're going to spend on food.
Yeah, a lot of people will just figure out how to get all the food out of their garden, and then they're like eating canned beans for the next 3 weeks because they fed all these people.
Right. So we're come to workshops, do this stuff. We want to put out the information to as many people as possible at once. We want everybody to be able to build a rocket stove successfully, so that we never have to teach it again. But that means you have to get us lots and lots of people so we can teach all of them.
Ernie thinks this is a problem that can be solved and finished, just like talking to people on Permies is something he has to finish before he goes to bed at night. I, as an educator, am aware that the world contains an inexhaustible supply of people who don't know things yet.
All right. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about rocket mass heaters, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.